Good morning. I'm going to call to order the first meeting of the Prison Population Task Force. I've got a couple of opening thoughts. First of all, let me say this is an informal task force. As all of you know, it was not set up in statute or anything like that. It was merely put together by myself and Representative Cornish to gather some information ahead of the legislative session. I suppose I could have done it as a part of some informal Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, but this seemed like a better way to formalize, if, to the extent we can, the gathering of the information to help us make some decisions next session, which is going to be a short session. So not going to be enough time once the session starts to do this kind of a deep thought on a very serious question facing the community in Minnesota. So a couple of details here. The meeting is being audio recorded, so all members of the task force should speak into the microphone when you're talking. In order to facilitate conversation, the meetings are going to be organized similar to a committee hearing with a chair, and we'll make sure that all participants should address through the chair as we do in normal committees, just to keep the group working well. I know the House is used to committees that are this big, but in the Senate we don't usually have a free-for-all like this, so we'll try to keep order here even with the House members. good luck. For purposes of the meeting, we're going to do some introductions. We'll just go around the room and let people identify your names and what organization you're representing. We're going to have a presentation by the Department of Corrections, sort of a background information, help us get a grounding on what the issue is before us. We'll have some discussion of what issues or topics the stakeholders would like the task force to address. And as I say, this is an open-ended concept here, so I'm not ruling anything in or out. I know Representative Cornish feels the same way. We want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to put on the table what they want to put on the table as we consider the issues here. We will have some discussion of the goals that the task force members hope to accomplish, which will help us give us some ideas for the next meeting or two of the task force in terms of agenda. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the next meeting, which is scheduled for October 18th. As I say, all options are going to be on the table for discussion, but I think we're going to be forced to prioritize since we're not going to have the opportunity, I think, the time to talk about everything that everyone wants to talk about in detail. I do want to thank everyone who is here today for taking the time to participate in this process, and for those in the audience who have an interest in the work that we hope to accomplish. The members of the task force were chosen based on their expertise or their interest in the area of corrections. There's a list of the members in your packets, ranging from the Department of Corrections to law enforcement, probation officers, to public defenders. And additionally, all members of the legislature have an open invitation to join the task force. There is, I think, one correction on the membership list. I don't know if I have a replacement name yet. I guess when I get Mr. Molitor is not representing the Association of Community Correction Act Counties. That's not his affiliation, but I don't have the name written down as to who is their representative. Senator Eaton?
I would like to point out that October 17th or October 18th is a Sunday, and I'm guessing you mean the 21st.
That would be a problem. We'll check on the calendar then.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're not going to meet on a Sunday.
Good.
Thank you. So in 2016, the legislative session is going to begin on March 8th. It's only going to last for 10 weeks. So it's important to engage in these conversations in a multifaceted way before we get there, because we have a growing prison population, and it's raised a whole lot of issues. There are a lot of valuable perspectives on the issue throughout Minnesota, and although it's not possible to include all of those perspectives at the table here today, I encourage everyone who's invested in this topic and invested in the future of the prison population to follow the task force's recommendations, or discussions rather, and participate in the policy proposals as they arise in these public meetings through the fall and the winter. This month, the United States Department of Justice released a nationwide survey of trends within each state's prison population. The overall prison population in the United States has been on the decline over the past year, but in Minnesota, it has increased by 3.5%, the nation's fifth highest growth rate. In the past, Minnesota has been a leader in promoting rehabilitation and in reducing recidivism, and for over 30 years, our state had either the lowest or the second lowest per capita incarceration rate in the country. But between 2013 and 2014, we slipped from second to fourth. This may not seem significant, but at a time when crime rates are low and the rest of the nation is more likely to look at alternatives to imprisonment, I believe that Minnesota can do better. It's also important to look at the issue in an even broader context than just our country. The United States has the highest population of inmates of any country in the world. To put it in another context, the United States represents about 4.4% of the world population, yet we house 22% of the world's prisoners. In comparison to other countries, even in Minnesota, we incarcerate our citizens at an alarmingly high rate. And in many communities of color, that number is staggeringly higher. This issue is particularly timely one due to the lack of space in our prisons and our state's growing prison population. Today, due to a lack of space in our correctional facilities, the Department of Corrections is housing 516 inmates in leased county jail space. And I understand they are reaching close to the available capacity there as well. Next year, the legislature will be debating a $141 million bonding request by the Department of Corrections to build a new prison housing unit in Rush City. And as recently deceased Yogi Berra said, a nickel ain't worth a dime anymore. A rising prison population does not have to be inevitable. Through this task force, I hope to look at issues of sentencing reform, increased chemical dependency and mental health treatment, the use of a parole panel, along with other policy issues the task force chooses to address. As the DOC's name reflects, our system is about correction, not simply incarceration, for the vast majority of inmates, most of whom will return to society. We have an opportunity to start the conversation toward policies that will not only address the growing prison population, but hopefully solutions that will reduce recidivism and provide more just outcomes for those in our correction system. Whether we end up concluding at the legislative session that we need to build some more prison space to accommodate increased sentences or referrals back into the prison system, or whether we look at ways to reduce those referrals or some combination, those questions, that information is going to be gathered, we hope, through this task force process. It is my hope that after the task force's work is done, the legislature will have a clearer path to an overall improved criminal justice system, one that will be a model for other states, once again, to aspire to. Thank you for being here today, and I want to recognize Representative Cornish, my co-chair on the task force here, for some opening thoughts as well.
Thank you. Well, good morning. My name is Tony Cornish. I'm the state representative from District 23. South of Mankato, Waseca, Blue Earth Counties, Watonwan Counties, and I'm a retired peace officer, and I'm in my seventh term, 13th out of 14th years. To give you an idea of the divergence of opinions that we're going to face here is that there's a number of my constituents that don't think there's anything wrong with putting people in prison. Especially when we read the papers and we find some of these people with 27 DWIs still driving, we find people that are raping and murdering that have been convicted and served three short sentences in a row before we finally got a clue and locked them up. I'm going to approach this whole subject with a complete open mind, but be aware that the House is wary of task force and recommendations coming out of them. We still have some residue in our minds from not all good from the Sex Offender Task Force that put out recommendations, and as you saw, the House didn't follow them. And so the House is a little bit different. There's more people there, and we go of more of an opinion of we like to let the representatives make up their own mind and don't want to come to them with preconceived notions that we think they should follow. Now, there's just as good a chance that I will, at the end of these meetings, conclude that we should build more prisons or increase sentences, and there's also a chance that I won't. And that's why I say I'm approaching this with an open mind. There's a lot of bad statistics thrown out there about incarceration rates, and we want to get to the bottom of it, whether it's demographics or ethnicity. We want to get the true facts out here and what's really going on. Just to say that some people are incarcerated more than others doesn't get it anymore. We need the real facts and people presenting those facts, and then we'll come to our conclusions at the end. So that's my general take on it, and I look forward to hearing from you folks. But make sure when you testify in front of us that you can cite statistics or facts behind it, and not just an emotional opinion. Have some. That's what we really like to get to, because we've got some really tough decisions to make, whether we're going to spend a lot more money putting people in prison or we're going to take a different route. So it looks like we've got a very distinguished panel, and from my beard you see I look extinguished instead of distinguished, but then you see me. Good to have you here, and I'll be interested in hearing all of your input and recommendations.
All right, with that said, why don't we go around the table here and just ask people to identify themselves and the organization that they're, or their affiliation that brings them to the task force. Let's start to my right.
Representative Dan Schoen.
Senator Barb Goodwin, I represent District 41, Columbia Heights, Fridley, New Brighton, Spring Lake Park, and St. Anthony.
Senator Chris Eaton, I represent Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park.
Sarah Walker, I'm here representing the Second Chance Coalition.
Kathy Sharon, I'm in the Senate. I represent Mankato and Eagle Lake in Blue Earth County, next to Representative Cornish and all of Nicollet County.
Joshua Esme, I work with the Council on Crime and Justice, a nonprofit where we work with helping people overcome the collateral consequences of criminal records.
My name is Bill Ward. I'm the State Public Defender.
Catherine Middlebrook, I'm the Chief Appellate Public Defender.
I'm Nate Reitz. I work for the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections.
Good morning. Mark Hazzi. I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
John Harrington, Chief of Police, representing Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association.
Scott Dibble. I'm a state senator. I represent a portion of Minneapolis, and I chair the Transportation and Public Safety Committee.
Representative Marion O'Neill. I represent Buffalo, Monticello, and Maple Lake.
Rayon Magnuson, I'm the Director for the Office of Justice Programs of the Department of Public Safety.
Representative Jack Considine, I represent 19B, Mankato and Eagle Lake, and I worked in locked institutions for 28 years as a counselor.
I'm Bob Small, I'm with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Rebecca Moses with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women.
Jim Franklin, Executive Director, Minnesota Sheriffs.
Josh Milo, representing Minnesota Association of Community Correction Act Counties and Director of Blue Earth County Community Corrections.
I'm Kelly Mitchell. I'm Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota Law School.
I'm State Representative Jerry Hertas. I represent 11 communities or cities in western Hennepin County that comprise about one-third of Hennepin County. And I want to thank everybody for their attendance and the great turnout this morning.
Kevin Kyer with the Board of Public Defense.
Dan Hall, Senator from Burnsville, Savage, Lakeville.
I'm Senator Scott Newman. I represent four counties in western or central Minnesota, McLeod, Sibley, Meeker, and a small portion of Wright County. I am a member of the Judiciary Committee. I'm also a member of the Transportation Public Safety Committee.
State Representative Raymond Dean, representing 59B, which is portions of Minneapolis, including downtown and the southern part of North Minneapolis.
Nick Zerwas, I'm a state representative representing Elk River, Big Lake Township, and a little bit of Otsego.
All right, I guess I didn't introduce myself. I'm Ron Lantz, a state senator, chair of the Judiciary Committee, represent St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Golden Valley, Plymouth, and Medicine Lake in the western suburbs. With that said, we're going to invite the Department of Corrections to come forward. They're going to give us some information that will help inform our discussion. I would ask members, if you have questions along the way, please go ahead and ask them. I'd rather have questions asked while they're on the top of your mind and we're on the topic at the moment. Just jump right in and we'll go ahead and do it that way. So Commissioner Roy and whoever else you're going to have with you for making your presentations, go on right ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairs, friends and colleagues, and legislators. We are very pleased to be here this morning, because certainly this has been an issue that has been on our plate for a number of years. To my left is Deputy Ron Solheide, who is in charge of our Community Services Division, commonly known as Probation and Parole, and in charge of programs that release people from prison. To my right is Deputy Terry Carlson, and her mission in this life is to manage our prison system and all the programs therein. And the prison population issue is prominent on her desk. Senator Latz certainly prefaced the issue very well in terms of national statistics and international statistics, and throughout the world, we are known as a country that certainly incarcerates a lot of people. This presentation that you're about to see hopefully will set the stage in terms of scope and scale of the issue within Minnesota. It is a presentation that will give you lots of statistics in some different formats that you may have not seen before. Some of these slides you have seen before, but at the end of it, I am hopeful that you understand what we are dealing with as a state. The only other thing I might say is that this has sometimes been termed as a prison issue or a prison population issue, but really this is a criminal justice issue. The Department of Corrections is the recipient of individuals who have made their way through a criminal justice system that at various points in that system can influence those folks that walk in our door. And a couple of our slides will talk about that. But onward and forward, and again, as Senator Latz has indicated, if you have questions, we have some, our research department is in the room. We have some documents that are in addition to the PowerPoint that hopefully will help some of your needs as well. But very simply, prison population exceeds capacity. And this graph demonstrates capacity in the blue line. And since 2004, the red line. And as of the production of this PowerPoint, the difference right now is between capacity and population is 560 bodies. We also think it is very important for you to understand the long term beyond today. And we have a very robust research department that works in unison with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and has developed a projection instrument that very accurately projects future populations in prison. And you can see that by 2022, we expect population to be 10,760 or so. But that is if everything stays the same. That doesn't anticipate new statutes or increases in penalties related to statutes, but it's kind of status quo in terms of existing policies and statutes. And of course, our current capacity stays exactly the same through that time. Female population, we thought it was very important to expand on this, and I'm going to look at Deputy Carlson because she certainly has some experience in our only female facility, Shakopee.
Good morning, everyone. Deputy Terry Carlson, Deputy Commissioner. I started my career as a corrections officer at our Shakopee facility in 1983. When I started my career there, the number of incarcerated women was under 70. And it is a population that has grown faster than the male population. Right now, today, our female population is 670. We have capacity for 650 women in our Shakopee facility, so we're always looking for alternatives, just like on the male side. As you'll see on this slide, the projections show that we'll be at 926, a difference of 270 again in 2022. So I just wanted you all to know that this is not just a male inmate problem. This is also a female offender problem.
And in terms of our Department of Corrections, right, of course, we do not have the flexibility of having a number of female facilities, but all services for our female population function out of Shakopee. This particular graph represents some more historical data back to 2001, and again, it adds to future projections as well. Sometimes those are referred to as the old days. I started in this system 40 years ago, and prison population was not an issue. And the growth, and I should have probably commented on when we were discussing the female population. I'm sure the question through your mind was, why has the female population grown so much? Well, those females are subject to the sentencing guidelines just like the males. And the days when I started, it was very unusual for females to go to prison. Often judges recognized that many female offenders were mothers, maybe were accomplices to male offenders, and didn't necessarily believe that women prosper in prison. Well, the sentencing guidelines, which have been in effect for 30 years, of course, 30 plus years, demand that there is no distinction between male and female offenders. So hence the growth in female prison population. And to a degree, the prison population overall is strongly controlled by sentencing guidelines. Representative Cornish, I think, referenced some of this ranking, as did Senator Latz in opening comments, and we should probably spend a little time on this particular map because it is very indicative of Minnesota's posture within the national scene. The numbers you see related to each state are the sentenced prisoners per 100,000 civilian population. So Minnesota circled, we incarcerate 194 individuals for every 100,000 population. As you go down the Mississippi River, Iowa 282, Missouri 526, Arkansas 599, and Louisiana 816 per 100,000. And it should be noted that Louisiana actually has 100,000 or a million fewer civilian population than Minnesota. And on the far right bottom corner, the national total imprisonment rate is 471 per 100,000 Americans.
Commissioner, excuse me, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we just heard from Mr. Chair that the prison population is high in Minnesota compared to other states, and I know I've heard that it's low before, but I'm trying to figure out how these numbers match up. So,
well,
excuse me one moment. Is that perhaps because, Mr. Chair, you were counting the jail population as well as the prison population in your statement, or why is this so different than what we just heard?
Well, we got our numbers from the Department of Corrections, so I'll let the commissioner respond.
Yeah. Then commissioner.
Actually, when you discuss prison populations, there's two ways to look at it. the overall number incarcerated. We have about 10,000 people incarcerated. Compared to other states of similar demographics, that's very low. We're fourth lowest in the country. We're a relatively small system. This particular statistic, I think, is the one that should drive our considerations, that even though we are small, we still can have a problem. So the ranking of 194 per 100,000 citizens, we are in the bottom five, as you can see, which is a good thing. But when capacity is exceeded, even those 500 individuals create a major problem for us.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hossie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, you have a later slide that compares, again, the U.S. And Minnesota. I'm wondering, can you tell us how Minnesota's incarceration rate compares to other countries, particularly other industrialized democratic countries?
Commissioner Roy.
I cannot do that intelligently, and I would hesitate to throw statistics out that I compare us Scandinavian countries, perhaps. But I would hesitate to give you that international comparison.
Could we get that at some point, Mr. Chair?
Okay, we'll ask the department to do a little research for us. Thank you. Deputy Carlson, you wanted to add something before.
Thank you, Senator Letts. In response to your question, Ms. Goodwin, we're going to go into the next slide, which talks about the growth rate. And Senator Latz's comments were directed towards our state having one of the highest growth rates.
So,
Commissioner, go ahead.
So if there are no further questions on this, I think you should be startled by this particular map and these statistics. And it certainly speaks to the difference in philosophy. My friends in Wisconsin, for instance, and Michigan, you would think would be fairly similar, but they have a different corrections philosophy, and the philosophy in similarly situated states can be significantly different. They rely on prison. We have a strong reliance on community sanctions, and we'll talk about that. And hence, our prison populations are low in comparison to similarly situated states. So this is a indicative and should be a concern to all of us. And this ranks the states in terms of prison population growth, the change from 2003 to 2013. We are in the top five of growth rate. And as I said previously, even relatively small numbers of growth can put us in a bigger percentage. So you can also see some states that have reduced population growth, but they may have been already incarcerating 3, 4, 5 times what we have been in Minnesota. So lots of the states that have shown smaller growth rates have been reducing prison populations by removing the low-hanging fruit in those states. And Minnesota removed the low-hanging fruit years and years and years ago. And that's primarily what the sentencing guidelines did. Sentencing guidelines kept relatively low-risk offenders out of prison, and our prison population is driven by the guidelines, which tell us to put person offenders in prison, people with longer criminal histories in prison.
Excuse me, Commissioner Roy, Representative Cornish has a question.
Commissioner Roy, how long have you been, have we been tracking the increase in growth, this spike in the growth, for how many years, and how serious is it? I mean, is this like a 1 or 2 year thing? We've just noticed it because it's relatively new to a lot of people. How many years has it been going on?
Commissioner Roy.
Well, the growth rate we've been tracking since I certainly have been here, 4 and 5 years, but the previous chart going back to 2001, statistically, and it's reported to the legislature every year in our census report. And it is a measure that has been pretty consistent with the department for probably the entire existence of the department.
So this chart.
Well, so this goes back to 1978, perhaps, and so these, with each year that's represented, or every 2 years here, we have numbers related to that growth, not only nationally, but also within our system.
Well, Commissioner, if that's it's been tracked that many years, why are we just talking about it now, all of a sudden, this spike? Is it a big spike just this year or last year, or is it, you said something about consistently. Has it been the same consistent growth? And if so, why are we all of a sudden paying attention to it?
Representative Cornish, in my reports to both committees, I have talked about the population issue that we have been facing. And if you recall, we have offered the remedy of county jails to take care of the growth, with some anticipation that we might see some decline in the growth rate. But our most recent projections have led to us making certain that we have a good strategy going into the future. And any strategy that we suggest to you folks may take 1, 2, 3, 4 years to accomplish what we wanted to accomplish. So we felt an obligation to bring this forward as a major issue within the department's, just as a keeper of the future.
Representative Cornish, part of the motivation was mine, is when I found out we were looking at maybe almost $150 million bonding request, it became clear we were going to have some major decisions to make as a legislature about lots of financial investment in the correction system. So it sounded like a good decision point to confront the question and see what direction we wanted to go as a state.
Another question?
Yeah, Representative Cornish.
You've told us a number of times in previous committee testimony that the people that were in prisons in Minnesota should be there. A woman wrote me a very emotional letter the other day about this committee meeting and said that our prisons were full of low-level drug and property offenders. What do you say to that statement?
Commissioner Roy.
Representative Cornish, we certainly have a mix of offender types and severities within our prison system. The profile of our offenders varies greatly from life without parole murderers all the way down to drug offenders who have zero criminal history before they enter our prison. And we have about 300 of those zero criminal history folks that enter our facilities every year. It is a wide variety of offenders, and the sentencing guidelines, as I have said, really drive the philosophy of Minnesota prison commitments. Person offenses, rapes, serious assaults, robberies, murder, all are ranked very high and all require prison sentences. But the guidelines also delineate the types of crimes that should stay in local facilities. And in Minnesota, and we will see in a matter of moments here, the difference in those two categories.
Representative Cornish.
Commissioner, would it be a safe statement to make that what some people consider as a low-level drug offense could vary in your interpretation? In other words, people in Stillwater and other prisons wouldn't be there for selling dime bags or low-level offenses. They would be there maybe with something listed on their offense that pled it down to, but wouldn't it be quite serious drug offense to be put into a state prison?
Commissioner.
Representative Cornish, there may be, and I would agree with you, that there are certainly drug offenders with those characteristics. Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Goodwin had a question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was just at a national conference last week in Oklahoma, and even the most conservative southern states, in fact, more of them than any others, were talking about removal of the mandatory minimum sentencing issue and talking about creating much more alternatives to sentencing than what they currently have right now. I just wanted to ask you about that, if you've noticed any difference in the increase in prison population since more mandatory minimum sentences have been put into place. And the other question is, and I'd like to ask, you're the warden, correct, for Shakopee? Are you the warden?
I used to work at Shakopee.
Okay. When I visited there, 70% of the people at Shakopee had a mental illness of the women in Shakopee. And I hear that 30% of the men do in the men's prisons have a mental illness or MICD combination. What I found in the research I've done in the last 3 years is that we have less and less resources to send people to for CD treatment, I mean per capita basically, and or to mental health treatment. So, and we are the lowest in the nation for the number of treatment beds we have for MI. So I'm wondering if you've noticed, and at Shakopee, if you've kept track of how many people with how that rate has changed, and if it has changed at Shakopee, up all the way up to 70% of the women have mental illness. I think probably there's a lot more in the male population, but I think that's self-reported. So the men are less likely to report that they do have a mental illness. So have you seen that population increase over the last few years?
Deputy Carlson.
Senator Goodwin, I don't have the statistics in my head about increases at Shakopee in percentages of people with mental illness. I think it's always been a much higher percentage than the male population, just from my experience. Right now, our data shows 25% of the men and 65% of the women, so your statistics are very, very close, do have regular and routine contact with our mental health staff and also use psychiatric medications. So it is an ongoing and very big concern for us in our facilities to provide adequate care to those numbers of people.
Senator Goodwin, regarding the mandatory minimums and the sentencing requirements, we have some slides that relate directly to that.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you're going to address some of the questions that I'm taking notes on, and I'll ask those at the end, but I wanted to bring up one thing related to the area Representative Cornish was leading to. I might be wrong, but like 3 years ago, didn't you come into the committee when I was first elected, the public safety, and give us, all of a sudden there was going to be this 1 year that is coming pretty quickly, that there was going to be this spike in population need, like of 500 beds you're going to be short in 1 year's time, or a significant number. It went from all of a sudden, you were tracking this for a long time, so what I'm trying to get at is this isn't coming at us out of left field. But so what is that, what was this number? Was it 300 or 500? And what year was that again? It's like all of a sudden it's supposed to be almost now.
Commissioner Roth. Representative Schoen, we've given lots of presentations over the past few years. I would be remiss to comment directly on what numbers I presented to you.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I just remember it was a significant number because everybody in the committee's jaw dropped and couldn't understand why, or, I mean, even fathom the idea that we were going to project that actually happening if we were going to be doing any reforms. So, thank you.
I don't believe our comments have varied too much differently than the charts that we have shown you here already this morning.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given Senator Latt's comments and concerns about the bonding issue, the 140 some million dollar bonding request that's coming up next session for Rush City, and given Representative Cornish's concerns and his questions, this might be a good time for me to bring this up, and I have a request for you, Mr. Commissioner. During the bonding tour, you and I discussed very briefly the fact that Appleton is standing empty, privately owned, and I acknowledge that you are not real interested in private prison system, and I will tell you I happen to agree with you. I think that Department of Corrections is a public safety issue and therefore should be within the public realm. But we did discuss the possibility of leasing that facility to the Department of Corrections. And for the committee members, that's a 1,500-bed facility sitting empty. The $140-some million bonding request is for a 500-bed facility at Rush City. And so my request to you, Commissioner Roy, is, I think, pretty straightforward. Can your department provide us with a cost-benefit analysis of possibility of leasing that facility run by the Department of Corrections? And I know that you had talked about administrative costs and so forth, but I would like to see a comparison of what it would cost us to lease that facility containing 1,500 beds versus building a new facility at Rush Lake and possibly others in the future for $141 million. And would you be in a position to provide that to us so that we would have that information available prior to the next session when we are going to be considering this Rush City bonding request?
Yeah. For Senator Newman's information, I had anticipated at least one of the topics at the next task force meeting would be a more in-depth analysis of the options at Appleton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was unaware.
We're on the same wave here, Senator Newman.
You're usually ahead of me. But the question remains, Commissioner Roy, are you going to be able to provide us with that information? And if possible, by the next meeting, that'd be wonderful. I don't know if it's possible or not. But certainly, Senator Latz and I are on the same track here.
As we are so often, Senator Newman.
And Senator Latz.
Commissioner Roy.
Senators, a wise corrections department always considers all options, but regarding the bonding and use of any other resources, we have not fully vetted with the governor or the governor's staff. So I sure hope there's no sense that there is a priority to any particular strategy right now. It's pretty early in the scheme of things, but we have many national studies of public versus private that are available. Our own department did a pretty robust public versus private study a few years ago. We have a very good financial department that does that kind of analysis all the time, so I think you can be confident that you will have information that will assist you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much, Senator Latz. And thank you for this presentation. Just to follow up a little bit, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I think that taking a look at what the solutions are once we get the situation described should be broad, and these things should be considered. And I don't think of it as public versus private. We're leasing space from the counties. Can we lease other space and then still have it be a state function? There's lots of ways to discuss how to proceed without accepting only one solution. So I appreciate you bringing that forward. But I'm sort of peeked ahead on your slides, and I'm hoping that what I'm listening for and what's helpful to me in your slides is that you're trying to describe the trend and what it is that's going to happen before we get into trying to say how do we deal with that, because it could be a variety of interventions from prevention programs to less utilization of community-based services to what our relationship is with the county. So what the method of response is for the future. But what I really need to hear now, as best you can, is your analysis of what is driving what's happening. Because if it is that the legislature has been increasing sentencing, the length of sentencing, you know, then that we can list that as a stimulus for this as a contributing factor, or if it's that we have mandatory minimums that we want to take a look at changing, then at least I have a list of the variety of ways in which we drive the outcome of a growing population in the prisons. And then we can go back, I think that's how I approach it, at which of those levers can we address most cost effectively and get the biggest outcome that we want, depending on what we agree is the outcome that we want. So that's really a comment. I'm just hoping that you hear me, that if I don't get it from here, that at some point I need to hear a list of the contributing factors that have been done as a result of your analysis that creates the outcome that we're getting, so that we know what it is that we're trying to address our interventions to.
Senator Sharon, it's a good segue to the next portion of the presentation.
Absolutely.
Before we go there, did we have Mr. Small, you want to say something?
I'll defer to the representative.
Representative Constantine?
My hope for this task force is that we're going to look at reducing the number of people that we incarcerate, not just look at expanding the need for more prisons. And if it's a short-term fix, then leasing, I think Senator Newman's on to something, and Senator Latz. But if it's going to be the long-term solution, why wouldn't we look at buying it instead of it's sitting empty? I would think you would get a good price at this point. But again, my hope is that we're going to look at how to reduce that population so we don't need those beds.
Mr. Small, I'm sorry, members in the audience, we are going to observe the same decorum in the room during this task force meeting that we do during the legislative session. I certainly recognize the passion and interests that people have, but unless you're going to be up here making a formal presentation, we ask that you please listen and not vocally respond to any of the comments made by the members of the task force. Thank you. Mr. Small.
All right. Mr. Chairs, Commissioner Roy, my recollection is not from a position of being with the county attorney, but rather from my time on the Hennepin County bench. And I had a recollection, and if I'm wrong, I hope that you would correct me. I had this recollection that when there were people that might be on some type of supervised release or parole, and they violated, and they had a particular relatively short period of time in which to serve, that we would send them to the workhouse rather than to prison. And the cost of that was being borne by the counties as opposed to the state. And the counties were very concerned about that. And I believe, and if I'm wrong, correct me, I believe they approached the legislature, and then the legislature came up with the decision to send them to prison rather than to send them to the workhouse. If I'm correct in that regard, and I think this is relatively in the time period that our prison population is increasing, is the increase a result of that legislative action to send people to prison to serve out the remaining time of their term of incarceration, as opposed to having had them serve it in? You're shaking your head, so I think you understand where I'm coming from. Is that increase a result of that legislative action rather than some other reason for this increase in population?
Given these lines of questions, why don't we go on to your next portion of your presentation, and I think we can answer some of them.
It's
going to
answer very specifically.
Oh, good. What a great question.
It was.
Thank you.
Commissioner,
this slide is another trend slide, and this is a good news slide for Minnesota, and it's one that people don't talk about very much, and it speaks to the efficacy of the strategy. Crimes are down, arrests are down, court filings are down, and probation populations are way down. What we don't show you here is juvenile population. In 10 years, juveniles on probation have declined by more than 50%. So we have some really good news in the juvenile world. The bad news is, of course, that those people that remain in our custody are and juveniles especially, are serious juvenile offenders. So here gets to some of the questions that have been asked very astutely. In Minnesota, 93% of all felons serve either a jail sentence or a prison sentence as a part of their total sentence. For those that don't, felons that don't go to prison, that do local time, the average local time is 106 days. For those that do go to prison, the average imposed sentence is 45 months. And the bullets below that, those statistics show that only 30% of male felons receive a prison sentence initially, 63% obviously then to get up to the 93% due time either in a community corrections facility or in a jail. And it gets to the notion of local resources being used significantly for felons. And you can see the breakout for females. Fewer commit crimes that demand a prison sentence, but lots of females do time in local facilities. And the essence of sentencing guidelines in Minnesota, of course, is that two-thirds of your time on a prison sentence is served in prison, one-third is served in the community. And those are defined at the time of sentencing, and that is sometimes called determinant sentencing.
So here is
the essence of what we have been talking about and lots of the questions.
Commissioner, is there any magic about the two-thirds figure there, or is that, that's how it's set in statute, right? But is it?
That's correct.
Does that vary around the country?
I'll defer to Mr. Wrights and Kelly perhaps can answer that question. Both have worked on significant studies of national sentencing guidelines. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, Kelly Mitchell or Nate Wrights.
Kelly? Nate, either one of you have?
I can.
If you could take a shot at it?
Yeah, I can take an initial shot. I don't have the numbers on the tips of my fingers directly, but we have a truth in sentencing provision in Minnesota, which means that the sentence that you receive is the sentence that you serve. And so we break it down so that an offender serves two-thirds of that time in prison and a third of that time on supervised release. Around the country, there are a number of truth in sentencing provisions, and the percentage that the offenders serve in prison varies depending on the jurisdiction. So I've seen it as low as 60% and as high as in the 90s. So it really is a policy decision for the legislature to determine what should that number be.
Thank you. Representative Constant.
I'm sorry, could you go back one slide? This slide shows that 75% of females serve time in community jails and 63% of males. A few minutes ago, we just heard about the high levels of mental illness. County jails aren't equipped to deal with people that have mental illness. They don't have people on staff to do it. I just wanted to point that out. If you're talking about a really high number of mentally ill people and you're keeping 75 or 63% of them in county jails, they're not getting the help they need.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you again. This is a historical recollection of major crime penalty changes that affect the prison population. And I think it's very self-explanatory, 98 weapons. The interest in dealing with firearms and violence led to increase in penalties. Failure to register as a predatory offender had a minimum sentence connected to it. 2002, the felony DWI statute was created. Domestic violence, a number of advocacy groups, and rightly so, approached the legislature saying we have to get more serious in this state with domestic violence. This is a listing of those changes. And getting to the meat of the discussion, and this particular slide is really tells the tale of how those things changed prison population. And I will draw your attention near the bottom to the felony DWI, because that's a great example of a legislative change in penalties and statute creating a felony level DWI. Currently, 683 individuals are serving time in our prisons for felony DWI. That is nearly half a prison. Weapons, same. The domestic abuse person increases. You can see pretty, we're in the hundreds. Drugs, very, very important. Meth has added a huge population in our facilities. We are seeing now other drugs that are adding to that, and lots of discussion around the country and in our Sentencing Guidelines Commission actually about drug offenses and drug penalties. Not prepared to discuss those at this time, but you can see how those changes in statute have led to significant population increases. Mm-hmm. And there's a story connected to each of those changes, of course there is. And lots of victim concerns, lots of public policy, community safety, quality of life issues. We did a study back in 2013 that I thought, we pulled the slide up and I thought it'd be interesting for the committee, and it might lend a little meat to the discussion in terms of rural versus urban.
Sorry, Commissioner, I'm going to interrupt you before you go to that slide. Representative Cornish.
Commissioner, you've uncovered a real problem here, is that these changes, you know, came from the people in some regards, and from law enforcement and from probably the County Attorney's Association and others to us. They passed through committee, through the House and Senate, signed by the governor to toughen up on crime and increase these sentences. So how do we keep from getting to spikes of highs and lows? We're tough on crime 1 year and we reduce it. And people are talking out in the hallways about letting people out of prison. So who are we going to let out? It seems like we're putting more in, and you know, some people are comfortable with that, especially some of these domestic abuse groups that are sick and tired of people, you know, being assaulted and killed. And so on one end, we're calling for stricter measures, put more people in, and the other end, all of a sudden now we think we have to let some go just because we're inched up a few points in the decibel meter or whatever. So it's a real problem for us, because I know if we start letting them go and then something else happens, all of a sudden the crime rate goes up, we're going to get people in here asking us for increased sentences. So maybe when Sentencing Guidelines people get up here, that'll be a better question for them. How good or bad is Minnesota? How do we rank with other states? And are we incarcerating the right people? And what programs are you folks looking at to change that? So hear from the experts.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would venture to ask, if we instead treated people with substance abuse and mental illness instead of incarcerating them, would that not decrease the population considerably?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Commissioner. We have outcome studies that look at chemical dependency, sex offender treatment, mental health treatment. And those studies indicate to us that treatment in our facilities reduces recidivism and return to prison, sometimes up to 20%.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton.
So if treatment is that successful, then why don't we do it instead of incarcerating people?
Mr. Chair, we have a system that does both. Unfortunately, our treatment affects only about 30% of those that come to us. The dollar figure attached to treatment is for about every 100 treatment beds, it costs about $1.2 million. So, two sessions ago, the committee supported expansion of our treatment programs, and we were very thankful that we got that money to do that. I could sit here today and suggest that we could take $50 million more and focus on treatment and have pretty good results. And we are, in terms of comparison to other states and other correctional systems, we do have pretty significant treatment numbers. Some states treatment is just a pastime that they don't really think is all that important.
Senator Dietzick. Commissioner Roy.
Yes and yes. It's people that want treatment that aren't getting it. And we also have a number of people that are ordered treatment at sentencing that we cannot provide, but they are expected to complete treatment as a part of their release plan in the community. Mm-hmm. And some communities really struggle with having treatment available. So it's a very imperfect system.
And Senator Dietzick, could you speak into the mic, please?
Sorry. Do you have an estimate of how many people, if offered and available, would accept and want treatment?
Deputy Carlson.
Senator Lott, Senator Dietzick. Our treatment statistics are such. Offenders who are assessed as needing treatment yearly, almost 3,000, 2,900. And we have 916 treatment beds in our facility, and treatment ranges about 6 months, 6 to maybe a bit over 6 months. So I think that answers the question.
Mr. Chair. All
right. Senator Goodwin.
The statistics I've seen on that is that treatment in prison is about 10 times more expensive than treatment in the community. So we are spending an awful lot of money imprisoning and jailing people that we could have caught early on, or we could have diverted from jail in the very beginning, at least for the low level and the drug crimes and so forth. So we need to keep that in mind on this task force, too, that we do need alternatives.
So thank you for those questions. I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on this slide other than point out that this is a urban and rural problem as well. This is a graphic that looks at the current prison population, and it's just another way of looking at the percentages or the actual numbers related to those types of crimes. And it should be no surprise to you that the blue 5,215 are person offenses, and that's really what the sentencing guidelines drives into our prison. Those crimes are ranked very high in terms of severity. And then the serious drug offenders, and again, the DWI weapons. But it shows the same growth rate.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Zerwas.
No, he's Representative Zerwas.
Sorry.
People make that mistake all the time.
Representative Dean, my mistake. So House members all look the same.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh, do we?
You guys can sort that.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, so when I look at that chart and I look at the combination of property offenses and drug offenses, I get to over 3,000 people. And if we reduce the incarceration rates of those offenders by even 25%, that would alleviate our prison problem. So have we begun to uncover and look at, and I'm not talking about these, you know, the violent crimes. I'm really talking about drug offenses and property offenses. Have we really gone and found some other low-hanging fruit that might still be out there? And I know there was an opportunity previously to enter into an agreement with Justice Reinvestment, and our state passed on that. At this time, and I know that other states that have done it have had huge increases in their populations, albeit they've had huge prison populations. So can you speak to that a little bit on there might be some areas that we really haven't uncovered yet that we should probably keep looking at?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll reference my previous comments about the different profiles of people we have in prison. And people progress through the prison experience in different ways. Even some offenders who come into prison with relatively low criminal histories or a low-level crime can become problematic in prison. You can't always judge by the level of offense. And certainly lots of those types of crimes that are in those categories have had some probation experience and some probation failures in their life. And I think the local judges and local corrections departments maybe have expired their interest in dealing with those people locally. Cabin burglars, for instance, or check writers who keep writing checks, or credit card fraud. Things that affect citizens greatly. So in addition to the types of crimes, I think what the consideration should be for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and certainly legislators is the penalties related to those crimes. And that is always an ongoing discussion with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. On the commission, we rank the crimes in terms of their severity, and by doing that, connect the penalty to them. That happens with every new statute. I think these statistics are ripe for review. I look forward, and I've referenced this report numerous times in this room, and this is an annual report prepared by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission entitled Annual Summary Statistics for Felony Offenders. This report answers basically every question you could possibly ask about why people are sentenced, who's being sentenced, where they're being sentenced to, what the sentences are of certain jurisdictions. It compares localities. It compares judicial districts. It compares criminal histories for similarly situated offenders. It is an excellent, excellent report, and I have suggested to Senator Latz that perhaps at a future meeting of this commission that the Sentencing Guidelines Director could make a presentation on the essence of what is contained in there. But, Representative, I believe there are people in prison that absolutely need to be there. I believe there are people in prison that can function very well in the community today.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, sir. You know, if you look at the numbers, though, whether you're looking at just over 1,100 property offenses or 1,900 drug offenses, the reality is those are quality of life crimes, and the property offenses. If you've been a victim of a home burglary, or a stolen vehicle, those are significant crimes, and likely we're not talking first time offenders, and we can say, you know, there's too many drug offenders in prison. You can say that up until they sell your kids drugs. And then you think prison's exactly where they belong. And so I think is there use in looking at broad scale reforms? Absolutely. But in the wholesale, people that are sentenced to prison, 9 times out of 10 belong in prison for some period of time. Now, do we need to look at mandatory minimums and those types of sentences? Absolutely. But this idea that if you're in prison for a property crime or a drug offense, you flat out don't belong there, that's just not true. That is absolutely not true. We have a very low incarceration rate. We need to make sure that the people that commit crimes and habitual criminals go to prison and stay in prison, and those that are reformable, or we can do early detention or early diversion, we can do that. But if you're a habitual offender, you need to be in prison. You've told society and your neighbors you can't get along well with others, and you need to be excluded, and that's just a fact.
Representative Dean.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just respond briefly to what you said. Representative Zerwas, 9 out of 10 of these people probably need to be incarcerated. Well, I mean, when you look at the over 3,000, that's 300 we can get rid of right now that maybe don't need to be in prison. So I think if we really start to uncover and sort of dissect what we're doing with our criminal justice system, and I'm not going to disagree, there are individuals that do need to be removed from society. There are also other habitual criminals that are habitual because of mental illness, because of drug addiction and other types of things. And if we ignore those factors, even with habitual criminals, I think we're really missing the point, and we're not increasing public safety, which I think the whole goal of what we're doing here today should be first and foremost increasing public safety, and secondarily looking at what we're doing with our criminal justice system and the increase in escalations of costs associated with it. Because as I heard Grover Norquist say, there's one thing that Republicans hate more than there's one thing that Republicans hate more than having people out that are in prison, and that is locking people up and paying a cost for those individuals that don't need to be out. So I think it's critical to stop and think about how we're spending our taxpayers' money, and are we getting, as I think Representative Considine mentioned earlier, a bang for our buck, with the primary purpose, of course, being public safety first. Thank you.
Commissioner Roy.
Again, this is a representation going back a little bit more in history, but just to remind you of the statistic. And
so we've talked about some of the impacts on prison population, and some of these are repeats, but just again, from 2003 until 2009 there was a law about short-term offenders not coming into prison. And that ended in 2009. That has had a dramatic effect on our population, and we'll show that in an upcoming slide. The domestic violence sentence enhancements in the mid-2000s, late 2000s, felony DWI laws were added in 2002. Life sentences, life without parole, sex offender law changes, those have been really ongoing over the years.
Development of a separate sentencing grid within the sentencing guidelines for sex offenders. Development of that grid, which came out of task force work, upped the prison sentences for sex offenders significantly. And that all sex offenders in this state are sentenced with that new grid, which has been in effect for 8 years. Mr. Kelly? I'm thinking 8 years.
It went into effect in 2006.
Okay.
It's less expensive than the security state on MSOB.
Representative Zero.
Question for you, Commissioner, with those incarcerated sex offender population, what percentage of those inmates will be released eventually? And then what's the percentage of those that are being provided sex offender treatment while in prison?
Commissioner Brock.
Chair, Representative, as I delay my response to you, I will be looking for those exact statistics. So as soon as she gets those, we will answer you. If we could proceed a little bit, or
sure. Give her a chance to look for
them. Yeah. I don't want to put anyone on the spot.
Thank you.
So we talked about the methamphetamine boom as well.
I found the information about the sex offender treatment. Right now we have 419 sex offender treatment beds in our adult facilities. Offenders assessed as needing sex offender treatment yearly are 596, and we have approximately 898 offenders entering treatment program on an annual basis, so you know they turn over. I don't find quickly the number of people the percentage that don't get treatment. Sorry. offenders successfully completing treatment are about 67% of those who enter.
And I would just stress that as we spend more and more time in, maybe not in this group, but in certainly in others within the legislature, talking about the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, clearly one need is the vast majority of sex offenders that we come in contact with will never be referred for civil commitment. We'll go from prison directly to being released, and many, many, many of them will do so without ever being treated with sex offender treatment. And so as we talk about different treatment programs, that is certainly one that our system is lacking. As much as we're talking about chemical dependency treatment, which we're lacking in prison, this is a significant public safety issue. And we talk about the MSOP and the folks that get referred there and what to do when folks get out of there. The reality is by far more significant of an issue is the numbers of sex offenders being released from prison annually and never being treated. It's a significant issue that up to this point really has not had a lot of attention that I think we should focus on.
Commissioner Roy.
Regarding the sex offender.
No.
I'm sorry.
I just would say that I think this issue of the sex offenders, and I think it relates to Representative Cornish's concern, too, that we make certain that we're talking about not just reducing numbers, but doing it wisely. And in some cases, we may want to increase the population that we have in the correction system as opposed to the civil commitment process as it relates to sex offenders. It may be a change we want to shift over in partnership with investing in treatment in the correction systems rather than relying on movement to DHS for that treatment process. So, and then I would just say that this has been introduced as legislation and considered in the Senate.
Commissioner Roy.
So we have been trying to manage our beds, increase our beds, grow our capacity internally, in addition to renting beds from county jails, because you know, we prefer to keep the inmates in our custody and care and get them the programming that we can, the education, treatment, get them involved in work. So we have expanded double bunking at a number of our facilities. Back in 2009, we opened the Faribault expansion, and that added 700 beds to that campus. You'll recall that way back in 2000, the Rush City facility opened. So this has, you know, been an ongoing increase, as we've said. We've expanded our challenge incarceration beds, and that's one of the things that I'm most proud of, because it's an early release program that saves beds. It's also an early release program that works. It reduces recidivism. And if you haven't seen that program, I would really encourage you to take some time to see the good work that we do with people who are involved in that program.
Representative Cornish.
I wanted to ask a question for my friend Representative Hillstrom that isn't here today. She wanted to be here but couldn't. And when I was chairing the budget session, she really needled me to force you folks to put more people in the challenge incarceration program. What inhibits you from expanding that even greatly or more so? Is it funding or is it space or a philosophy? She wants it really increased. What's your response to that for her?
Representative Cornish, we're looking at that right now. It may require some statutory changes to expand, but quite honestly, that's one of the things with the challenge incarceration program is one of the things that we do want to increase. I don't have good facts and figures for you right now because we're just looking at what the statutory changes may be that we would request. A lot of it is current capacity and the staffing required to accommodate that program because it's a very program-rich environment. We've expanded the female population from 24 to 40. That program is now down at our Shakopee facility, and we're talking about what more we could do. We've expanded our challenge incarceration program for men. Togo facility now has a component, a 45-bed component, and we're talking about converting a weight room at our existing Willow River campus and adding, I think it's 45 more beds in that room, and then moving that function somewhere else. It requires some staffing changes. Some of that we can do internally. Some of it we may be asking for money.
I think the important component of the challenge.
Sorry, Commissioner, hold on a moment, please. Mr. Small.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, on this recent impact on the prison population, thankfully answered my question on the short-term offender program. My question is this: as I understand what you told us, there's 516 prisoners in leased jail cells. My question is, of those 516, how many would have been in jail anyway but for the change in this law? In other words, of that five, are we really not talking about anything other than a shift in cost? We still have the same number of people in a local facility that would have been there anyway but for the change, and that the cost is just being borne by the prison system rather than by the county. Is my question convoluted?
It is convoluted but understandable.
Thank you.
We have a slide coming up that really shows the number of short sentences.
You always do that.
But it's hard to say exactly if those two populations are directly shifting or compensating each other. I was the director of a county facility that took short-term offenders, and back in those days, the state paid $12 a day to local sheriffs and corrections administrators to take these short-term offenders. It was not popular, and the statute, many people in the community corrections world were glad to see it go away, and sheriffs, I think, were glad to see it go away as well. We currently pay $55 a day, and that meets, I think, reasonably accomplishes both our goal and the sheriff's, and it's not, doesn't sometimes meet total costs, but I think it's better to have $55 than $0 in an empty bed. So this next slide is really, really important, and I think this is the notion of this whole committee, that prison population issue is not necessarily just a corrections issue. Lots of things impact prison population. Police practice, certain municipalities and counties may have different emphasis on different crimes and different crime apprehension. Bar sweeps, for instance, or a jurisdiction that really wants to focus on DWIs, that might not be shared by all municipalities or counties. So individual police actions, drug interdiction, those practices vary around the state. I think, and I don't hesitate to say this at all, but I think the most important position professional in the criminal justice system is the county attorney. County attorneys wield great power, and charging practice, plea negotiations are determined by the philosophy of that elected official, and that if you look at the sentencing report that I just referenced, it's pretty clear that there are differences in practices in terms of how different crimes are dealt with around the state. It's a huge, huge issue. Some downward departures, and I'm not saying a good issue or a bad issue, it just exists. I think over 95% of cases in the state of Minnesota are plea bargained, and those plea bargains are controlled by county attorneys. Very, very important people. But certain jurisdictions, departures from the sentencing guidelines can vary 30, 40, 50% from judicial district and from county to county. So the disparity exists in Minnesota for good or for bad. Sentencing guidelines, of course, we've had a lot of discussion already about the importance of guidelines, and I would suggest to this group that the focal point for many of these felony issues falls within the Guidelines Commission. We have, for the past year, been looking at a variety of crimes, trying to compare jurisdictions, trying to compare states. We have yet to come forward with a resolution affecting the guidelines. Guidelines can be affected two ways. Those notions of guidelines changes can come from the Guidelines Commission themselves and be authorized by the state, or legislatively, those particular guidelines issues can be affected as well. So it's two routes to sentencing guidelines changes. Mr. Director, did I properly say that?
Yes, right.
And of course, the application of the guidelines I just mentioned varies greatly. Some judges have judicial philosophy that on certain crimes they will not depart from the guidelines. Other judges and other judicial districts, departures for certain crimes are pretty significant. So the judicial practice enters in here as well. Really important factor is the availability of community sanctions and treatment. Those counties that have strong community corrections departments, they have community corrections facilities, they treat sex offenders, they treat chemical dependency, they have a robust probation department. Judges often will say, I would rather have our offender going to this community corrections facility than going to prison, because I believe that community corrections facility does better work. And again, there is some parts of the state, those types of facilities don't exist, hence those types of offenders come to prison. And significantly different resource allocation around the state. Probation violation response also varies significantly. Counties that have those good community corrections, strong departments or county probation offices sometimes deal with offenders and violators much more aggressively. Some give them more breaks than others, but certainly we have a good number of probation violators that come into our prison. And of course,
Commissioner, I was under the impression that there's been an increase in the prison referrals for probation violations that are more technical and nonviolent in nature compared to past years. Is that correct?
We have a significant number of people that come back for violations. If, for instance, we looked at 2015, we had about 8,000 prison admissions. 5,200 of those were new commitments. 2,758 were returns without a new sentence, which means they were parole violators. Only 53 came back with new sentences. So parole violations, supervised release violations, are a significant issue for the state of Minnesota. 2,758. 34% of intakes last year were parole violators.
And have you noticed that, has that increased? Is there a trend in that number?
Senator Letts, Mr. Solhader, the number, we did a study in 2009, and the number has increased slightly, but it has been approximately 2,400 to 2,700 release violators returning on revocations every year since that time.
And that's almost completely within the discretion of the judge that's reviewing the case, right? I mean, we don't we don't provide a lot of statutory guidelines from that standpoint. I mean, you get the probation department or the local community corrections person decides, okay, now we're going to bring forth a violation. We go in front of the judge, get input from the interested parties, and the judge makes a decision. Is that violation worth sending back to prison, or should we leave the person in the community with some additional oversight?
Senator Latz, if I can clarify, we have two types of violators. We have probation violators who are on the front end, and that is through the court system, and the decisions with regard to violating and sending to prison is with the courts and with the judge. The release violators are those who are on parole status or supervised release status in the community. That is within the decision-making authority of our hearings and release unit at the Department of Corrections. So that is by independent hearing officers, and the guidelines that they utilize for those revocation proceedings are in promulgated rules.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a clarifying question?
Yeah, Representative Schoen had a question first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and any one of you who may be able to answer this. So if we're taking that 2,758 returns that were not a new sentence, right, is that the number? So what's the breakdown between probation and then the release violation? Do you have that information? I mean, one that came, so what's the mix between what comes from court and then what comes from within DOC?
Senator Latz, Representative Schoen, I do not have that breakdown with me today. The 5,700 new commits to prison that the Commissioner Roy referenced include those probation violators, so I'll get that breakdown for you.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Schoen.
And then are we tracking what specifics those are in why they're coming back? I mean, I'm only speculate that a great number are a dirty UA, and they don't remain clean, and so I have some concerns that, you know, we set people up for failure the minute they walk out, and we don't, I mean, you put them back into fire and they're covered in gasoline, they're going to burn up, and it's not going to be pretty. So how are we addressing those concerns? I mean, environment is a huge issue, and if their family situation isn't right, and I know we count on that, the minute they come into prison, and if we put somebody in on a short term, if they're there a year and a day, the minute they're there, they're already should be working on reentry programs, right? Mm-hmm. And so how, I mean, this breakdown, if they don't have the skills already to be out in the community, it's how do we expect them to succeed? I mean, and follow through. We know morally and ethically, we think, well, if you want to be free, you should do this. But when we interject addiction and those issues, we know it's a game changer. We can't ignore that, right?
That's right.
So I'm curious about how that breakdown comes into play.
Senator Latz, Representative Schoen. We are pulling data together for future meetings for this commission that gets to what our probation violations look like, as well as what our release violations and our release violator population look like, and we will be breaking that down by the type of violation. And I can tell you here that the majority of those violations do involve drug and alcohol use. Clearly, that is the largest number of violators that we have. But I will also say that in most cases, whether it be a probation violation, and oftentimes even with a release violator, that first use oftentimes results in a restructure, not an automatic revocation and a sentence back to prison or a return to prison. Even the courts and the judges are reluctant to violate first-time drug use on probation violators. So there is a lot of screening and triage that goes on prior to somebody coming back to prison.
Mr. Esmond.
My question was along the lines of that asked by Representative Schoen.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been an interesting discussion so far. A couple of questions and maybe a comment. Just recently you mentioned about of the 8,000 new entries, 5,200 were first-time offenders or commitments. Does that mean that they are first-time offenders and go straight to jail, or can you differentiate what numbers of people are are coming into the prison population who never have been a problem or convicted of a crime before that actually are first-time offenders. You've got the one prison population offense graph that's interesting in breaking down the different types of offenses. And I think most of us would agree that people who violate in some of these categories are an inimical threat to public safety and should go to prison. But then there's a number of other categories here that maybe not so much. And if we're talking about overcrowding our prisons, I'd be interested in understanding the data of how many first-time offenders go directly to prison. The other question I had, and I want to just make sure I had it right, with regard to the issue of a potential bonding request, that $140 million was for about 500 beds, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Two units.
I think my comment is that, you know, this is not like watching how it's made. We're not talking about widgets here. We're not talking about the same predictable outcome based on inputs and how we put somebody through the assembly line. We're talking about real lives, real people that are removed from society, the impact it has on their family, on friends, on other people. And yet we have a fiduciary responsibility to manage our resources wisely. And I, sitting here, I kind of worked out a spreadsheet here, and $140 million for 500 beds works out to be $280,000 a bed. And that, I'm a real estate guy, so the capitalization cost of $280,000 per bed, and that doesn't even count the debt service on the bonding. So if you annualize that cap cost of $280,000 out over a 30-year life, we're spending $10,000 a year per bed. And then if you add the debt service on that money, at 1%, we're spending $12,000 a year per bed. At 3%, we're spending $17,700 a year per bed. And at 5%, we're spending $25,000. And that doesn't even count maintenance, utilities, doesn't count the staff, the overhead. And we're talking about a huge amount of money that we really ought to be looking at those first-time offenders and understand the value of youth intervention programs and treatment programs and making it clear that these individuals can avoid prison towards changing their life and through proper treatment. I think we can reduce the cost to our society, not only in terms of dollars, but in terms of the impact to the rest of us and those who threaten public safety.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Roy.
Regarding the no criminal history, the previously referenced guidelines report, it doesn't meet your question exactly, but there was about 15,000 people sentenced with felony level offenses in Minnesota. Of that 15,000, about 4,800, 33.5%, had no criminal history on their sentencing guidelines. Not all those people went to prison, but about a third of felony offenders walk into our courts with no criminal history. That accumulates a point.
So, Commissioner, a criminal history does not, I mean, it takes a lot of misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor cases to get to a felony point on a criminal history. So it doesn't mean they haven't been involved in the criminal justice system up to that point. It's just that they haven't done anything serious enough or often enough to accumulate that first criminal history point. Is that right?
Hence my comment about that would accumulate to a point.
Okay.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Okay.
To continue, so
we
talked about the impacts on intake. Now I want to talk about some of the impacts on prison release. Extended incarceration is a term that you may not be familiar with. It's a process that we have available within our facilities to deal with offender misconduct and refusal of directives. It extends their incarceration time into that one-third supervision time and can go up to the expiration of their sentence. So we have been paying close attention to how much extended incarceration time we are internally giving to offenders in our prisons for rule violations, and are very, very mindful of the fact that that impacts our overall bed space. We've been working on initiatives to reduce the amounts given for assaultive and other really dangerous behavior that happens in prison. We've also been talking about and are close to implementing a process whereby an offender who's had really good behavior over a period of time could get that time restored so that they could get out of prison earlier, not before their supervised release date, but earlier, and not extending them. Challenge Incarceration Program, as I mentioned earlier, is a good program that saves bed days for us. Some offenders can get out of prison up to 42 months early, and that saves a lot of time for us. Currently, we have about 450 offenders who are on CIP release supervision.
Who normally would be in prison.
Right. Ron, do you want to talk about work release?
Certainly. The work release program at the Department of Corrections, we annually have about just under 600 people who release through work release, which is prior to their two-thirds time. So they're being released early to private employment in the community. They are housed in adult halfway houses and jail facilities around the state. On any given day, we have approximately 220 offenders on the work release program in the community, which saves us prison beds as well.
Senator Latz.
Senator Scher.
As you're talking, I just need a clarification on something. I'm referencing back to the two-thirds, one-third. So when you're talking about this work release or the challenge incarceration program, do they in the second phase of the challenge incarceration program or work release, is this occurring in the one-third rather than the two-thirds, or is it during the two-thirds?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Sawhead.
It is in with the two-thirds period, so they would normally be incarcerated. These are persons who are released prior to that two-third supervised release date. And I would also note that those in the challenge incarceration program who are in the community phases, the challenge incarceration program is typically 18 months in length with 6 months in prison, phase one. The other two phases are in the community under intense supervision, so that utilizes our supervision resources in the community.
For the work release program, is that at about the right level and numbers of prisoners that you think is possible, or could that be expanded?
Senator Latz, what we're looking at with the work release program is attempting to expand it, but it is limited due to the number of beds available in halfway houses and county jails that we can board these individuals in. We are looking at some changes to the work release program to hopefully increase the number of offenders that we have out on work release.
To continue, we also have the conditional release program that was reinstituted a couple of sessions ago. It doesn't have a huge impact on our population. I think that in 2014 we had four conditional release program releases. We currently have 10 people on that status. This is for offenders whose crimes primarily dealt with use of drugs rather than big sale of drugs, and if they complete chemical dependency treatment, they can get out of prison early. The conditional medical release process.
Same question I had for Mr. Solhad then with regard to the conditional release program. If you had more resources, could you make more use of that?
Absolutely.
How many people, how many beds are accounted for there? How many more resources? Is that a fun, going back to the commissioner's comment, we could take $50 million more and do more treatment and get more people released in this way, or is that an overstatement for this particular program?
I think it might be an overstatement. I mean, if the legislative intent of this program is that it's for very low-level drug offenders, and when Mr. Solhide and I review these cases for people who are interested in the program, there's a lot of criminal history, there's a lot of failures, supervision failures. So it's a matter of risk.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, a number of those offenders have lengthy treatment histories as well. It gets to Representative Cornish's comment about drug offenders in prison. Lots of them have had failed supervision and failed treatment. And the notion behind this program is good. The other issue is they have to complete treatment while they are inside to earn this capacity or earn this status. And sometimes we don't, as we previously discussed, have the capacity to treat them, and hence they don't qualify.
Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I just want to ask if you have separated. I know when I went to Lytle Lakes to visit, the largest number of prisoners there were drug offenders. I just wonder if you separate those that have are there for using versus those that are there for selling.
Senator Lott, Senator Goodwin, we do not separate them by their crime type.
Thank you.
To continue on with the possible prison release options, conditional medical release is also a status that's used to release people before their supervised release date. Currently we have, I believe, 7 offenders on this status. These are men and women who have very serious health concerns that really are better met in a community setting, a nursing home, a hospital, an extended care, maybe the Department of Human Service Forensic Nursing Home. So it's not a big driver, but it is an option that we use. Community supervision, that speaks for itself. Sentence completion, those are the offenders who serve until expiration of their time. And then also release by death, unfortunately. In the fiscal year 2015, we had 9 deaths in our system.
Representative Considine.
We're conscious of your time here, Mr. Chair. Do you have a direction on the time?
You got 1 minute left. No. Okay, let's go to Representative Considine, and then we'll try to get you wrap up by 11 so we have time to go around the room to talk.
The inmates that Commissioner Roy described as problematic a little while ago, and the ones that you are extending their stay because of discipline problems, would I be correct in saying that the vast majority of them have some sort of mental health problem?
Commissioner. Chair, Representative, I couldn't say the vast majority, but clearly mental illness impacts discipline and discipline dispositions. They can't get along with other inmates. They can't get along with staff. They're often assaultive. And as a result of those issues are receive segregation time and receive extended incarceration. You're right.
So that's a yes?
For some. I can't say the vast majority.
A significant number, though. A
significant number, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along with that question, I'm wondering, I want to make sure that you mention that people with a mental illness in jail and prison are more likely to be assaulted than people without a mental illness, too, rather than just the ones that are assaultive. They're also very much at risk of being victims.
Absolutely. And to that point, Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, we have a very active crisis intervention training going on.
Good.
We are very proud of our department, that we are the biggest corrections department in the country, or have the most people trained. All of our segregation staff are trained in crisis intervention, dealing with mental illness. It's some of the best training that we give, and many of our corrections officers say that they should have had this training right away.
Thank you.
So right. Here, this gets to the question very quickly of the profile, and this talks about the admissions and the short term, and this surprises a number of people, that we have a significant number of inmates and offenders that do relatively short time with us, and this graph talks about that. We have well over half that are with us under a year, so that gets to be a real challenge in programming. We call it the churn, 8,000 in, 8,000 out every year, and it's an amazing number of people that are processed through St. Cloud on intake and other facilities, but this should enter into the discussion too. What kind of programming do we do for these people? What is most effective? If there is a mental health issue for somebody that's with us for under 6 months, what significant intervention can we really do in 6 months?
So these are some of our special population groups, and I'll just tell you that we have 1,500 inmates who are over 50, and that's considered geriatric in our terms for our offenders. I'm there too. Youthful offenders, right now we have 10 offenders who are under 18 in our adult facilities. We talked about the mental health issue. 25% of the men and 65% of the women have ongoing mental health concerns, and addressing them their needs is very challenging. 90% of the offenders are chemical abusive or dependent, and we have 916 treatment beds. The extended incarceration that we do for accountability and control for behavioral problems, assaultive, dangerous behavior in prison. And then life without parole is another special prison population. Right now we have 579 Minnesota life sentenced offenders. Of that, 123 are serving sentences for life without parole.
And basically those life without parole beds are gone. They'll be occupied well into the future, and life without parole is being talked about nationwide, especially for the young offenders, the youthful offenders that come in with life without parole. It's removes hope from the future, and after 30 or 40 years, perhaps that is a changed individual, perhaps not. So we talked in yes, to get time here, we've talked about a number of these things already. They're in your packet. We are exploring lots of options. Again, it's not a single solution for this problem. And I think we have covered everything here.
Senator Deasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've talked a lot about the mental health issues and chemical dependency issues that the population has, and Representative Hertas, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He mentioned early intervention, and I'm just wondering, of the population, how many of your prison population have do not have a high school diploma or GED?
I believe the answer is 75% do have their high school diploma or GED upon entering.
Is that right?
When they come in, 40%.
Sorry.
Want to speak?
Easier.
Just identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Grant Dewey, Research Director with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. To address the question, when offenders come into prison, roughly 40% do not have a secondary degree. When offenders leave, approximately 20 to 25% do not have a secondary degree.
All right. Thank you, Department of Corrections. I think what we'd like to do now is just to go around the table. Oh, Commissioner, any concluding remarks?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to conclude by saying that we agree with your opening comment that everything is on the table. We have not fully vetted any of these potentials to the degree where we're ready to say this reflects the governor's solution or this reflects the governor's attitude. These are notions that we've explored within our department. We've introduced several of them to the governor, but at this point in time, they don't represent the governor in any way other than the commissioner talking about them.
All right. Thank you. So let's go around the room and give each member a couple of minutes to identify if you've got some particular suggestions or items that you'd like to either get information on or solutions you'd like to get more information or have more discussion about that will help us prioritize and set our agenda for the next couple of meetings. So, do you want to say something before we go in order?
Mr. Chairman, are you going to go in order or are you going to?
Here, you know what I'll do? Rather than just going around the table, why don't we start with the non-legislative members? And I didn't quite want to say it, but thank you. And I'm just going to use the list that I have here of the agency and public members of the task force. And then if I've missed anyone, please let me know when we're done with that. We've already heard from the Commissioner of Corrections. I assume Ms. Lonergan doesn't have anything to add at this point to her agency's presentation. Janet Marshall from the Judicial Council, did you want to say anything, Janet? All right. Nate Wrights from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Mr. Wrights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the slide that stuck out at me from Commissioner Roy's presentation was slide 15, which summarizes various policy changes that the legislature's made in the time period from the late 90s. Another policy change, and I think many of those policy changes took offenses that the offense itself would be a misdemeanor offense, but for the offender's criminal history, in the case of the assaults or the violations of the protective orders, because of the offender's criminal history having two priors, the offense becomes a felony. Likewise, the DWI, the offense itself is a misdemeanor, but because of the three priors that the offender has, it becomes a felony. It's not insignificant how many prison beds are taken up by folks in that category. Another policy change that we're looking at right now in the Sentencing Guidelines Commission goes back to the 90s, which is reducing the weight for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine to get to the, for example, the first degree level. That was reduced by 1/5 for sale and 1/20 for possession during that period of time. Significant prison impacts. I think of the requirement that the legislature has given the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to periodically review the impact of the decisions that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has made and determine whether or not its decisions are creating the effect that it intended. And I think that one of the potential benefits that could come out of a task force like this, Mr. Chair, is to potentially review some of the choices that the legislature's made over the past 10 or 20 years and determine whether or not those changes have met and are continuing to meet the goals that the legislature had in mind when it enacted those changes in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Breon Magnuson from the Department of Public Safety. She is no longer in her chair. We'll come back to her. Catherine Middlebrook from the Appellate Public Defender's Office. Ms. Middlebrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. I'm also as a member of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines, I agree with what Nate Wright said about what the guidelines is focusing on. And I think one of the really important things is looking at the drug crimes and also the mandatory minimums. That seems to be a really big area where a lot of individuals are being sent to prison based on mandatory minimums that probably do not need to be in prison and can be put into the community, and there's alternatives. Also the other big area that I see should be addressed are some of the probation revocation cases, particularly where they have not committed a new crime or they're really technical violations and they really could be helped within the community rather than sent to prison. And many of them have very short-term sentences, so that's a good population that I think is in that short-term frame, that they're not getting any treatment or anything while they're in prison. One other area that I think is really important to look at are these enhanced felonies that are based on the misdemeanors, and then they're enhanced to the felony level. One example particularly are the Dankos, because if there's one Danko, there's probably eight of them, and it very quickly gets that person to a felony level, and they may not even be anything more than a phone call. So there's some of those areas that I think are really important that the task force should look at on trying to reduce and look at what's going on with the prison population.
Thank you. Mr. Kyer, Board of Public Defense.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question or issue was a little along those same lines. Is we had a lot of information about what's kind of driven the prison population between 2000 and 2015. And my question is, what's driving the estimates? Because there's an awfully large bump, I think it's in 2019. Are those the same issues that we have seen that have driven the population from 2000 to 2015? And I'll give you the example is, I think the number was felony DWIs or 686 versus zero in 2000. Well, we all know we didn't have felony DWI there. So is the commissioner expecting that those increases are going to continue into the future? My hunch is they're not. So is there something else that's driving those? The second one is that after hearing some of the comments from you all, is a lot of what may end up happening is going to be dependent on what happens at local communities. And do we have some information, or maybe it's on the agenda for a future meeting, about what our local jails are at in terms of capacity? Because it sure seems like we're going to be moving people, or potentially moving people back and forth. So I don't know if that was on the agenda for a future meeting or not, but that I know they've been at capacity before. I don't know where they are now. And then the third one is on the women offenders. As a percentage, that's a larger increase than even in the men. And I know there are fewer local options for women offenders. So I guess more of an idea of what are we going to do with that, because we're certainly not going to put them at Rush City. So those would be kind of the three things that I was thinking about.
Thank you. Bill Ward.
Because there's three of us here, I guess we get three bites of the apple here. You know, echoing along with Representative Constantine said, I think the biggest issue that we should be addressing as a committee is not only do we have a prison crisis, we have a probation crisis. We have 100,000 people on probation in this state. I don't think people realize that number. It may have gone down, but it's 100,000 people on probation. And what I see driving around the state and talking to lawyers in my office and to clients is, and was said by Commissioner Roy, is just there is a lack of resources in the, you know, many of the 87 counties in the state to provide the appropriate treatment to individuals who are on probation, which is 100,000 people. So, you know, the idea of throwing $150 million into prison, I understand that, you know, there's a need for revenge and retribution and putting people and incarcerating them, but there needs to be a substantial amount of money that's spent at the local level for appropriate treatment programs and not the cut-and-paste programs we have now.
Right.
Way too often the bench is only provided with certain treatment facilities for a one-size-fits-all mentality. They're not really looking at the individual, the mental health issues, Does that facility do a good job at treating certain types of addictions, or is it the only one that's in town? Mm-hmm. And way too often it's the only one in town. And that's the reason we're getting the probation violations. I don't blame the bench for being frustrated when the person messes up, but ultimately that's the pipeline to, then to prison. So unless and until we address those issues on a local level, we'll never have enough money to build more beds for prisons. I mean, that's the issue. The other issue, and I'll make this brief, is I don't believe, because of, the resources, that we do a good job, and it's not a criticism of corrections, Department of Corrections, Community Corrections, but it's a criticism of the judicial system or the justice system in general of using evidence-based practice. We tend to put the low-risk, low-need people in the same category as high-risk, high-need. And every study out there would tell you that we are just insane in taking that approach with individuals. The reason we do that is because we don't have the resources to do a good evaluation of the individual when they come before Judge Small when he's on the bench or the other members or to the probation officer. So they're treating them the same. So the first-time DWI offender is treated the same as the fifth-time DWI offender. I mean, it's the same approach. And again, the research tells us that's absolutely wrong. So our approach in the system is going to increase the population in the prison based simply as to how we approach and apply our various jobs every day in the system. And so we have to get back to evidence-based. I know Community Corrections knows about evidence-based practices and deals with that. And from a top level, they understand it. How it's being implemented with the individual officers is a different approach altogether.
Thank you. Bob Small.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, our association was very supportive of the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, and this seems to be a growth of that, and so we're certainly supportive of that. Of course, our goal is to maintain public safety and to work with everyone to make sure that people that are in prison ought to be in prison, and those mentally ill and those that ought not to be in prison aren't there. And our association is very interested in working with everybody to see that that's accomplished. It's important to our association, however, that whatever savings are realized from a reduction in prison population would be passed on to the counties so that the counties can then provide those services and that necessary treatment. So that's the interest of our association. Thank you.
Joshua Milo, Association of Community Corrections Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First I'd like to respond to how we're treating offenders, whether we're treating low risk and high risk the same. I would absolutely say, and I can speak for MACAC, which does supervise over 75% of offenders in Minnesota, is that we treat them very differently. I could say I don't think sentencing guidelines treats them differently, and I don't think our state treats them differently when we look at offenses of those in prison, but how we supervise varies a great deal whether a low-risk or a high-risk offender. We very much don't look at near as much at the offense anymore, but look at the risk and the needs of that individual based on validated risk instruments. So someone that is a high-risk individual is receiving significant supervision, or somebody with low risk may receive very little or almost no supervision at all, because we're needing to focus on the high-risk individuals. Having said that, I think we could supervise we could focus even more on high-risk individuals with the resources if we had more resources. We talk about our prison population and being a very low prison population, but when we look at probation, you mentioned about 100,000 people. We're the fourth highest user of probation in the United States. We're able to keep our prison population low, which we could argue that's not a good thing if our crime rates are high, but I think what we've seen, and hopefully we'll get into that later, our crime rates aren't higher than those that are using prison beds at a much higher proportion. Just look at our neighbors around us. So it's really significant. Our quality of life is staying really good as a result of how we're doing things with community supervision. But I do think we could be at a breaking point if we're not willing to invest in the county services, whether it's probation, whether it's chemical dependency treatment, whether it's mental health, reentry, housing. Those are things that prevent people from coming back into the prison institutions, because really for us, it's about recidivism. We, in probation, do we believe that prisons are needed? Absolutely. Do we have people that we're very happy when they go to prison? Absolutely. Do we want them to be there a long time? Absolutely. But our goal is low recidivism rates. When we're working with them, that's our goal, is how do we keep people in the community? We don't want to send them back to prison. We want them in the community being successful, paying taxes, you know, going to school, having education. So it's really about putting all of those resources, and do we appreciate that we did get some increases in Community Corrections Act funding this last year? Very appreciative, but I look at our department where it resulted in about a $50,000 increase for a budget, and then another department, state department, reduced our funding by $40,000. So it's pretty modest. It didn't really help us a whole lot, even though we appreciate what the legislature did for us. So for us, I just say, let's make sure we look at where the recidivism rates are. Community supervision does work when we have the resources, and we will focus on those highest risk offenders when the resources are there for us. Thank you.
Amy Chavez, Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers.
I would agree with representing
the Minnesota Community Probation Officers. I would agree with the safety priority. All right. Thank you. More resources. Rebecca Moses, Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women.
Chairs, we thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this important conversation. We recognize the complexity of these issues, and in any policy analysis, we really feel like robust data is needed. If we're looking for policy solutions, if we're looking for policy changes, what is the lay of the land? And I think today was a beginning of understanding data around these issues. I think we're really interested in information about detailed criminal histories of the prison population, demographic statistics on folks with criminal justice involvement, so race, income, ethnicity, geography. Really also interested in recidivism and reoffense data. What is driving this? Finally, data that cross-references criminal justice system information with other systems information. So prior to and post incarceration, what has been the child protection involvement, not only as victim but also as offender? What has been the juvenile court involvement? What has been protective order court involvement? What's been immigration court involvement? So we're looking forward to, I think, robust data to drive policy conversations. The second thing we would like to address is the perspective MCBW has on evaluating proposed policy solutions. First of all, and this has been mentioned today and in the statistics that we saw, also mentioned by Chair Cornish, I think we really want to look at how do we meaningfully get to accountability for domestic violence offenders, as well as safety and determination for victims. For over 35 years, Minnesota has been a national and international leader in addressing accountability for people who have chosen to commit domestic violence against intimate partners and their children. And I think we do not want to see that eroded. The issue of accountability is forefront for us, as well as victim safety. I think there are questions about how we get to accountability, but we do want, as we evaluate policy, these are priorities for us. I think the second thing that we balance as we address policy solutions is how do we address bias and disparate impact for communities of color, for people living in poverty, for people with histories of mental illness, for people with histories of victimization and trauma, and for many other communities. And I think these are two priorities that MCBW weighs as we explore policy solutions. And so again, we thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this dialogue and are looking forward to learning more from robust data collections.
Thank you. Josh Esme.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The piece of information on the slide that stood out for me today from the presentation was this idea of the churn and the amount of people who are spending relatively short times in our prison population. And I'd like to see this task force take a good hard look at whether or not we're making good decisions about what intervention we're using here. Is the decision to send people to prison the best intervention, or are some of these other treatment options more use of probation, more use of diversion, that type of thing that has been mentioned today, a better option in a lot of these cases. Specifically, I think mandatory minimums have come up a few times. I think that's one issue that this group should take a hard look at. I know speaking with practitioners, one area that I've seen that come up a lot is with repeat drug offenders, there's a big conflict there between some of the great work that's going on in our drug courts and specialty courts, which are designed to be able to serve people who are really struggling with addiction, but that's exactly the type of population that we can expect to have repeat offenses, and then the mandatory minimums get in the way and forces an intervention that is we know to be less effective. And then the other thing that I'd like to see this group sort of recognize and take a look at is that the decisions that are made with regard to our prison population and our criminal justice population as a whole is not an isolated system, right? And it has effects. It has collateral consequences. It affects people's ability to get housing. It affects people's ability to get employment. And so it all comes back to this idea of whether or not this intervention is the right intervention, knowing that we're expecting people to come back in the community and succeed once they're done with the criminal justice system. And then one piece of information that I didn't hear talked about today that I'd like to see information on going forward is more information about the racial disparities within our criminal justice system in general and our prison population specifically.
Sarah Walker.
Again, thank you so much for the opportunity to participate in both chairs. So much has been said that I would probably echo, so I will try to be brief. But I think, first of all, I would like to look not only on the number of people of probation and how that's driving the prison population, but also the length of time that people are being spent on probation. There was discussions of evidence-based practice, and all the research shows that 10, 20-year probation periods actually do not benefit the offender at all and can actually have the opposite effect. In addition, it's costing a lot of resources to continue to monitor people for this length of time, and Minnesota has some of the longest probation sentences in the United States. I would also like to examine more of the return violators, but also I would like some analysis of the cost it takes to simply, when we violate someone, we actually send them to county jail, then they get processed, they go through the hearings and release, then they go back to prison, and all that is a very costly process. And so does it make more sense for another alternative that's either in the community or otherwise, or perhaps looking at who, if we're violating the correct people? Also, I would like to hear more about the criminal history points and how they affect both racial disparities from the sentencing guidelines, I'm hoping, and also how that's driving prison population growth. And related to that, I'd also like to possibly look at the makeup and history of the guidelines and to see if it's still headed in the right direction and representative of what we're hoping to achieve today. It seems like it's increasingly balanced or weighted towards the executive branch with fewer and fewer community voices, and I would say not a lot of accessibility or access or understanding of the process to the vast majority of the community. And finally, I am also interested in some of the special populations that the Department of Corrections has noted, specifically geriatric populations. This is one of the driving costs of corrections across the United States. For people who are inside the Department of Corrections, they cannot receive any sort of health care benefits, so the state fully pays for all of the health care costs of those inmates, and many of them are so infirm that they are very unlikely to commit crime. So it should be a place where we're looking for creative cost solutions that will both allow people to be released but also save the state, you know, millions of dollars potentially. So thank you.
Ms. Mitchell.
One of the advantages of disadvantages of going later is that everybody said what you already thought of. But I think I'll take the time to echo a few of those thoughts. The churn also really impacted me, and I remember from my days at the Sentencing Guideline Commission working on that prison population forecast, and the numbers of new admits, probation violations, and release returns are, you know, about split evenly across those three groups. So we really do need to look at those violations and figure out why they're occurring, where they're coming from, and is there a different response that we could impose? The 6 months prison terms maybe are not the most effective use of that resource, and those are coming from those violations. So I really do think that we need to look at that. I would also echo the length of time on probation is an issue in Minnesota. The longer you watch somebody, the more likely you are to catch them doing something wrong. How many of us could actually go for 20 years without doing a single thing wrong? So I do think that we should consider whether it's time to look at the way that our statute is written, because right now probation can be ordered up to the maximum sentence for that offense, and in certain parts of this state, that is done routinely. Yet there are other states where, you know, 3, 5, 7 years is the max you could ever get on probation. So the 30-year probation sentence is completely foreign to them, and they're getting along just fine without it. Finally, the last piece that I would like to say on the evidence-based practices issue is I know that probation in Minnesota has done a really good job of trying to get a handle on evidence-based practices and applying the appropriate supervision and level of programming to the offender based on their risks to reoffend and their needs, their criminogenic needs. But we also need to make sure that the judges are on board with that process, because if they're issuing orders that include conditions that aren't in line with what that offender needs on probation, that gets in the way of effective programming. So I think that we just need to make sure that those activities and that approach is aligned in Minnesota.
Mark Costi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers has submitted a proposal regarding drug sentencing that's mirrored in Senate File 773. And that was introduced last session, and the Department of Corrections has already done a fiscal analysis of that, and that would save almost 800 beds in the long term per year. Now, I realize that there's some parts of that proposal that the legislature may decide are not appropriate for Minnesota, but it does not touch on things that have been covered today, like probation violations and release programs. It's just drug sentencing changes. And as an example of low-hanging fruit, there's one provision in there that just makes the stay of adjudication a presumptive disposition rather than a permissive disposition for first-time low-level drug offenders. And that alone would save over 100 prison beds. And I appreciated Mr. Wright's bringing up the fact that, you know, we have to look, we can't have too short of a memory on these issues. The Department of Corrections just went back to 1998 as far as changes. If we go back to 1989, when our drug sentences were drastically changed, and look at the increase in our prison population then, it's vastly greater than what we've seen over the last few years. So I hope that we can look at that more closely. And also I hope that you know, folks from a political standpoint will take a look at what's happening around the country. There is growing bipartisan support, especially for drug sentencing reform. And then I just want to take just a minute to put this whole issue of our prison population in a little bit of a different perspective. I was in a meeting just earlier this week where somebody said, just because you're the prettiest person in your family, if you're from an ugly family, it doesn't make you pretty. I wouldn't have said that myself, but I thought it was appropriate here when we start patting ourselves on the back for having the lowest incarceration rate in the United States. Minnesota, as we heard from the Department of Corrections, has an incarceration rate of 194 per 100,000. Sweden has a rate of 60 per 100,000. Norway's is 72, and Finland's is 58. Now, there may be some policies in those countries that we just could not get to here in the United States. But coming maybe a little closer to home, you know, ours is 194. England and Wales is 148, and Canada's is 118. So let's just set the bar really low. Let's say we wanted to decrease our incarceration rate or the beds that we're using by 10%. That would save us 1,000 beds. We could solve this problem, not spend this money, and maybe have a bunch of other money to put into some programs we've heard about that are much more effective, like drug treatment. If we did that, just reduced our rate to 100, that would be a rate of 175 per 100,000. Instead of our 194, we'd have 9,000 people in prison instead of 10,000. We'd still be significantly higher than England and Wales' rate of 148 and a lot higher than Canada's rate of 118. Thank you.
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, members, no matter what is going to come forward, there's probably going to be dissent of one kind or another. So I guess that's what the legislative process is all about. I look forward to that discussion. I hope we keep one thing in mind. We are picking one taxpayer pocket. We're not state money, federal money, local money. It's one taxpayer pocket. The real question, I think, focuses, how are we going to spend that dollar? And I think there are some questions, Mr. Chairman, that I would like to have from sheriff's perspective. What's county probation? What's county doing? What county jails can do? Could we exceed some of the things we are doing? Early intervention is key here. We know about the mental health issues. They plague us to no end. And I think the solution is local involvement quicker rather than later. And so I think we're very interested in some of those kinds of things. We also think that we have a flawed process. It doesn't flow quick enough. I have a jail where we're 500 day in a commitment process. That's unbelievable amount of time to go through. So we need to try to address some of these things. If we're going to streamline the system, and I don't know if we're going to go that way and make those kind of recommendations, but I think this is something that could span a couple of years, but I think there are some very good ideas around the table and some things that you might find that we might even support and be in favor of, especially on a pilot trial type basis. And not all counties are going to be able to deliver the same level of service. But we have four, five, six different regions. We have multiple cities in those regions that are regional cities. And there's a number of ways that we could perhaps look at delivering services slightly faster, better, and maybe with quicker results, better supported by community advocates. So we look forward to that debate and discussion.
John Harrington. Welcome back, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, our primary focus is still going to be on public safety. But we recognize that there is a difference between real public safety and fear. As I looked at the list up there of the different stratifications of people that were incarcerated, what I saw was a history of a reaction to different social fears that we have seen, whether it's the sex offenders after Drew Shodin, domestic violence is more recently, shootings in one of our downtowns, which ratchets up our reaction to gun crimes. All too often what I see is we are reacting to the fear of what's going on rather than actually looking at what is really going to be efficacious in terms of remedying that. Having said that, local police chiefs are going to be responsive to local concerns, and we are as close to the victims as anyone ever is. We hear the voices of the victims who cry out for justice and who do have that fear, and we are going to have to be responsive to that and cannot overlook that. Having said that, we recognize that it is pennies on the dollar for prevention and intervention in comparison with incarceration. And where there is effective prevention and intervention models out there, we believe that that is where we should be putting our dollars rather than simply blanketly putting folks into incarceration. A couple of other items. One piece that we talked about was what was the educational level of the individuals that were incarcerated, and I would skip from what educational level to actually asking the question of how functional are they in terms of how educated are they. So many of the young men that we come into contact with, and young women also, may well have a high school diploma, but they are functionally illiterate and are not, they cannot function in a world where to get even the easiest low-level job, you have to get on the internet and be able to fill out an application there. And finally, the last item that I would note is the post-incarceration piece. I was out in L.A. recently at Homeboy Industries, and where the logo there is nothing stops a bullet like a job. And what are the collateral consequences of incarceration in terms of when young men and women come out of incarceration, can they find employment? Can they find housing? If they cannot, have we not, in many regards, set them up for failure and set them up for return to prison?
Did I miss anyone here on the task? I mean, non-legislators? Ms. Magnuson, would you like to add something?
Thank you. Just a couple comments. First, I would echo most of the remarks that are in the room, particularly Rebecca. Thank you for saying many things that we would agree with. For me, at least, as a representative of the Office of Justice, DPS, we are, number one, of course, very concerned about public safety. But I just want to reiterate, we really want to make sure that the victim's perspective is heard as you move forward with redefining this particular system. So when you're looking at either programs, either to change guidelines or, say, to increase some of the programming that the DOC is already doing, just to make sure that the victim's perspective is included, and, of course, we're very happy to work with that because, of course, many of these changes will affect them directly. I do appreciate being here today, and thank you to both Senator Latz and Representative Cornish for what I feel is a balanced approach and having all these different people at the table. Really appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Legislators. Let's just go around. I think that'll be easier than picking anyone. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so a couple things that come to mind. Commissioner Roy, I think we really got to be able to get the statistics on when it comes to the drug offenses, users versus sellers. At some point, that's got to come out. Because I hear this, and I think that is part of the discussion that we're seeing played out in the street. Streets right now, and the protests of what are we going to do about criminal justice reform, and a piece of this is we have to know how many people are there because of use versus sales. I argue many times, and I believe it because that's the business I work in, that you know people don't end up in prison over a little bit of use, and there's always tied to something else, which also ties into, are they there because they pled to the drug offense because of the other offense was so much more egregious in the first place, and then maybe it was a person crime they were sketchy on being able to get a case on, and they said, hey, will you agree to, even to the victim, will you agree to the drug offense? They'll serve 36 months. The other offense we're not so sure on, and they go, okay, fine. The discussion on when you brought up the Dancos, I was waiting for Miss Moses to fly out of her seat. And I think the same thing is going to happen when we start talking about any alcohol-related offenses related to drunk driving, because MAD and the domestic abuse advocates are going to be climbing down every politician's throat if we even try to touch that. So we do have to have some discussion about it, because I don't think we should be afraid to have those discussions. So from the advocacy side, when we start talking about this stuff, we need the advocates also to give us a little bit of wiggle room to discuss this. Before we go into an election season where both the Senate and the House are up this time, so now you're going to have to make some political decisions when we do policy. And
never do that.
And the there's a load of different things here. I want to understand why we have 916 beds only for treatment, and I guess I look at this as there's day treatment for people in society. Why can't we do that in all of our prisons? And that may be happening. So I'm not asking you to answer that, but maybe a little more clarification how that works of, you know, why can't you get treatment if you're in any bed within the prison system that's functional? Or what is different about those 916 beds? Looking at, we see those six-month prison terms. What were they before? You know, I feels like sometimes we see these 6 months that we see coming in for the probation offenders or whatever, that maybe would have been 2 years previously versus 6 months now. So I hope we're making those directions that we are ratcheting down. And I'm also interested in, you know, our population as we grow over saying, well, we want to reduce the prison population by numbers, but I think one of the more important numbers to look at is, you know, where are we at per the 100,000, because our population is increasing. And then I'd like to know, what if we had crime X on this? If you said, we legalized this drug or we legalized that drug, then what does that do to our population as a whole? right? I mean, that's part of the discussion we're having in criminal justice reform as a whole, is why are some crimes even crimes? I think I've heard that discussion. I know Representative Hertas has brought that up many times, where we look at, this is what we had for felony numbers this many years ago, and now we have this many number of felonies. And so I think that I'm back with Representative Zerwas, however, that when that crime happens to you, it's the biggest deal in the world, and we can't ignore that. So if it's, whether it's, look at the financial crimes that were related to stealing someone's identity. I mean, you want to tear somebody's life apart. I mean, that's a big deal. And you know, I started in law enforcement 14 years ago, and Chief Harrington is spot on. When you're standing there with the victim of an assault or whatever it may be, you don't get to see all the way through and all the ramifications, and they're never going to understand why that person didn't spend time in jail. And that's hard to explain. And you know who they blame it on? They blame it on the cops. And then the other part, too, is if we're looking at what should we enforce, we're the policymakers as legislators. We send a direction to law enforcement about what society thinks is important. And as law enforcement officers, we can certainly, we have discretion, but we also have to take orders and do what we're told. And if you tell us and society and me, as well as a policymaker, say we don't want you to enforce this anymore, so we're going to take it off the books, then it's also my job as an officer to say, sounds good, no problem, we'll just work with whatever you want, if this is what society wants. So we've got it's an interesting space for us to be in. It's long overdue, and thank you for bringing up the racial disparities. I didn't think it was, I was hoping that it would get to, somebody would bring it up that wasn't a person of color before it got to me, since we only have two on this at this table today, which is, I will say, is a little bit disappointing. I think we're going to hear from some of the groups as well that represent people of color. And because that is, there's legitimacy to that. But I will say this one thing, and this is how vast this issue of criminal justice reform goes. If you really want to address criminal justice reform and you want to keep people out of prison, then we give them a good education and make sure they have living wage jobs. End of discussion. Now, there's going to be those people that are never going to be fit for society, but there are some of those folks that if they had had some opportunity, they wouldn't be there.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I really do want to thank the chairs for putting this together, because it's high time we all get together, those of us concerned about the issues or working in the issue of criminal justice, and try to come to some compromises. Now, there's one area that did that, the Child Custody Task Force, and issues that I thought would never be resolved around the legislature, and that it was very controversial, but they did. They got together all sides of the issue, and they came up with wonderful legislation last year that made the system much more fair, and I'm hoping that we could do that with this, too. I'm also hoping that we can stop using the issue of crime as a political football, where conservatives are using it against Democrats or against liberals, and the opposite as well. I think that the whole nation is looking at this issue. I think some of them long before we did, long before we started looking at it. And so this is really, really an important process that we have here. I've often seen these task forces meet and then people kind of drop off after a while. I hope that doesn't happen, because we need all of you, and we need both parties on this task force and both bodies as well. So I think we can make some real differences here. There's already an awful lot of agreement on some of the issues that that we know we need to fix. And it sounds like, you know, among different parties and different groups, we all kind of agree on some things. When we went through that tough on crime period, and I was in the House then, I remember thinking, this is going to be crazy. We're going to pay for this. There's just too much going on here that we don't really know what the long-term effects are going to be and why we need to go this far. So now we're taking a look at it again. I hope that we can take a real honest long-term look at it, because in the legislature we're more likely to do legislation that gets us through our term or through our next election. We need to look at it as the future. This is just too expensive. And in the case of mental illness and chemical dependency, we see a dramatic, and I've been looking at this for 3 years, a dramatic increase in jail time and prison time because we don't have other resources. Those areas were cut. Chemical dependency, mental illness, through the years we were increasing the crimes, we had budget problems too. So it had to go from somewhere, and that's where it went. And now you can see the effects of that. And people that should have had help all along in the county jails, we've got people that are going in 4, 5, 6, 8 times a year. That is so much more expensive. We have 10 times more people with a mental illness in prison than we have in treatment. 10 times more. That's a lot. We have the fewest treatment beds of any state in the nation. We need to get going on this, and we need, and we can. We can reduce jail time and prison time. And, you know, I think the Department of Corrections is going where it thinks it needs to go if we don't do anything else. They're saying, I need 500 more beds. Well, they do if we don't do anything to change the system. So I can see that everybody here is definitely sincere and passionate about doing that, and I'm happy to be part of it. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for putting this together.
Senator Dietzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank both of the chairs for having this task force and creating the task force, and for allowing us the opportunity to be here. I'd like to thank everybody else at the table. It is good to see such a large group, and everybody also in the audience for being here, because we do appreciate your input, or at least I would appreciate your input. I have another meeting to go to, so I'm going to be very brief and just say I agree with what Senator Goodwin and Representative Schoen said. Thank you.
Thank you, both chairs. One thing that we did do a little differently in this last session was that we actually expanded specialty courts to all 87 counties. And I've been out in the counties, and every single county I went to are greatly desiring a specialty court. I just was in Wright County. Before that, I was in Sherburne County. But the disconnect is they don't know how to do it. They don't know how to start it. And we were only able to fund it with money I would call a placeholder amount of money. And you know, after touring almost all of the specialty courts in Ramsey and Hennepin County, it's an incredible place to do a lot of the diversion types of things. And so I would just really encourage us to take a look. We mentioned it very, very briefly, but how incredibly helpful specialty courts are in the diversion process and getting people help, getting them mental health services, getting them chemical dependency services. And let me just talk briefly about the chemical dependency services that Senator Goodwin is just talking about. Something that you need to think about, because I actually worked in the field, and I worked for a very successful nonprofit here in Minnesota, that not all chemical dependency treatments are created equal, particularly when you're talking about chronic offenders. Who are in our court systems are the chronically chemically dependent. You know what? Let me just tell you that if you have an ongoing issue like that, and you've been intoxicated for 20 years, it's going to take at least 3 months to detox. If they're in prison for 6 months, they haven't even had a clear mind to even figure out what they're doing. I saw this over and over and over again at the nonprofit I worked at. We really need to think about, if we're going to be increasing funding for chemical dependency, to think about, first of all, inpatient, not outpatient, because inpatient actually works. You're talking about controlling what they eat, controlling the programs that they go to, making sure that they get exercise. It's a holistic plan. Let's not send them to prison. Let's not send them to jail. Let's send them inpatient. I mean, we've gone so far away from that. When I first got my degree, we were doing 60-day inpatient. Then it was 30-day inpatient. Then it was no inpatient. And I'm telling you, if you have someone that's chronically addicted, you have got to give them the opportunity to do at least a one-year inpatient. And my fear is that when I talk to this director of this wonderful nonprofit that had a very high success rate, that in this last legislative session, he came to me, he said, they're trying to take away my funding. And he is incredibly successful, and he has a it's a 1 year, and sometimes it's a longer than 1 year program. He has a 60-day program, but he also has the 1 year program. We have to look at what is successful. If we're really going to get at the crux of this issue, we need to look at making sure that we're funding adequately, not outpatient, not for the chronically addicted, because it's not going to work. It takes them 3 months without using a chemical just to be able to think clearly. And I saw it over and over and over again. And guess what happens when they can finally think clearly? Then their emotions start to come up. Why do you think they're addicted? Because they have had incredible pain and trauma and loss in their life. And so when you start to deal with that, you've got really intensive therapy you have to do at that 3 month mark. And you need to make sure that they are so supported that they don't leave. Because that's what they do, is they start to feel and they start to deal with the pain of their life and they leave. So if we're going to fix this problem, we really need to look at it in a holistic fashion, not outpatient, because guess what? They can go through 15 different treatments and nothing changes. So we need to look at what's successful. If they're chronically addicted and they've already failed over and over and over again, it should be inpatient, because you can control the aspects of their life that they need to have controlled, because they are out of control. The last thing I want to talk about is the emergency mental health beds. And I appreciate you saying that, Senator Goodwin, that we are ranked either 49 or 50th in the nation for the number of emergency mental health beds that we have. And we've cut funding, to the point where when I went to the Mayo Clinic to talk to their psychiatric department, because I wanted to find out more about this amazing program they were doing with those that have bipolar disorder and major depression, and they were drug resistant, and they were doing a behavioral study. So I went there with that intention, and guess what happened to me? For 2 hours, the top executives of the Mayo Clinic brought me into the bishop's room with three other representatives that were there, including Representative Liebling at the time, who was the chair, and said, mental health. For 2 hours straight, the Mayo executives were saying, we need more emergency mental health beds because people are in the middle of a severe mental health crisis and we cannot find them a bed. I have heard that in the community, in Wright County, in Sherburne County, everywhere I go, including the Mayo Clinic, when I had no intention of listening to what they had to say. I listened to what they had to say, but I'm saying I didn't go there with the intention to talk about emergency mental health beds. And I realize that we have slightly increased the funding this last time around, but we need to seriously increase the funding. You want to keep people out of prison? Let's look at real treatment that works for both mental health and for chemical dependency.
Let's circle back to Senator Dibble, who stepped out of the room.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair and Chair. I'm glad this $150 million bonding request has triggered this conversation, because I think in other states they've just kind of blindly built prison after prison after prison, and they've gotten to the point now in some states like California, Wisconsin, other places where their Department of Corrections and their overall criminal justice system is rivaling what they're paying on their K-12 education system. And we don't want to go down that path in Minnesota. This whole subject is actually fairly new to me, and it's actually fairly out of my depth, both politically, professionally, and personally. Commissioner Roy will tell you the first prison I ever visited in my entire life was just this year. Just starting to...
Is that on a tour?
Yeah. Yes, fortunately it was. I mean, I've been to the jails in Hennepin County, but first prison I've ever set foot in was up at Stillwater. The two prisons up there, pretty eye-opening. So I'm just starting. It's good timing for me too, though. I met Piper Kerman earlier this year. She's the author of Orange Is the New Black, and Before You Laugh, the book that she wrote relates very little to the TV show, and I would commend everyone to read it. It's a very, very interesting book made up of little vignettes about what we're really struggling with, and I think Representative Schoen really hit the nail on the head. We're dealing with a broken economy and a broken education system, and we've talked about a broken healthcare system. People are failing in many ways fundamentally in their own lives, and and our society is failing them. They're, of course, responsible for their own behavior and their own choices and that sort of thing. But we've got a broken system, and kind of where it all kind of ends up is in the Department of Corrections and our prisons and the like. And so I hope we have some conversation about that. And, of course, I
will not do my own committee or committee that I used to have jurisdiction over elements that I used to be the professional or the political champion for if I don't talk about youth intervention programs and juvenile detention alternatives. So I hope we at least touch on that in our conversations here. But really, having this, you know, very high level, very simplistic, we've already touched on all this stuff, but that's kind of where I am right now. What is getting folks into prison in the first place? To what extent are folks ending up there? Who should not be there? You know, of course, accounting for their accountability, but if they should not be there, what are the better outcomes with alternatives that we have? Once they get there, and again, a lot of discussion about that. What are we doing to help them solve the problems in their lives? So they're getting out as soon as possible, and they're staying out. You know, and that, of course, is all the things we've talked about, you know, health care, mental health services, CD services, job services, housing, et cetera. If you read the book, you'll see that, you know, it's a fairly progressive state that she was incarcerated and had all these programs, and they were a joke. Now, I'm sure Commissioner Roy delivers high-quality, high-level services, but I don't know that because I've only kind of dipped my toe in all this, so I really want to understand that. And then there's a whole set of issues around culture and attitude inside the prisons that contribute to successful outcomes. And that's just kind of in the daily interaction with staff, how rules are applied. I mean, there's just a tremendous qualitative aspect to that and how those incarcerated are regarded, are treated, are allowed to be successful, and allowed to build on their success in the life. And that's something we don't talk about a whole lot. That has to do with the service delivery of these programs, this education, this treatment, all that stuff. But it's also just the daily enforcement of rules and how people are regarded and the like. And then, you know, in terms of, you know, the things that get them there and the policies that we've enacted over the last few years, are we really getting out of that what we want, the felony DWI? It's kind of accepted that that's a bad thing because it creates a half a prison's worth of new population. Maybe it's a bad thing. Maybe it's not. I don't know. I voted for that. I thought it was a good thing at the time because it seemed like we had a big gap in holding folks to account who were conducting themselves in that way in our larger society. But, you know, now we're a few years down the road. We've got almost 700 people locked up for that. Are we getting out of that what we wanted? Can we have an analysis of that? So I'll stop talking now. Got a lot more, but I don't want to go on forever.
Representative Consonant.
Thank you to both the chairs. I think I'll just try to make three quick points. One, I am a big supporter of the CIP program in prison. I believe that it gives people a chance to work towards their release. I like that idea. On the area of recidivism, I believe that the literature is clear that the single biggest impact on recidivism is a raise in the level of education, and number two is treatment, whether it be for mental illness, alcohol, or drugs. Three, on the front end, I think as a state, as a society, we need to make a determination whether we want a punitive system or we want one that is a correction system. And once we have decided that, I think we'll be able to build more prisons or do stuff on the front end and try to keep people out. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hurtles.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, both chairs, actually, for having this committee. Some of my thoughts are with regard to the data. For example, if there are 10,000 beds and we've got 365 days in a year, that's 3,650,000 sentencing days. It might be worthwhile to understand just how many days of sentencing are our judicial system handing out. We look at beds and capacity. We have data about number of new entrants into the prison system, but that doesn't maybe correlate necessarily into really understanding what our potential to deliver the penal system in terms of number of bed days. I also, regarding data, am concerned, as Representative Schoen had mentioned, about the data just lumping drug offenders into one group. We clearly need to understand those who have addiction problems versus those who are making an enterprise of the system. And the penalties regarding those who choose to use drugs as an enterprise certainly ought to be looked at differently in terms of quantities and possession versus somebody who is a first-time offender. We can't underscore the importance and value, as has been previously mentioned, about that segment of the prison population, although small, is youth. We need to be looking at youth intervention programs and their effectiveness, the efficacy of which, you know, we keep those young people out of prison. The recidivism rates in there. Mr. Franklin, I guess, has left, but I heard from some Hennepin County prosecutors that the recidivism rate with regards to DWI dramatically went down when they expedited a more expedient process of adjudicating these crimes. For a while there, adjudicating a DWI charge was taking more than a year to actually bring that to conclusion, and during that time, oftentimes really victims of young people would have a sense of despair and not really take seriously the consequences of DWI and would reoffend within the period of which they're still waiting a trial on the first charge. There's a high incidence of those who are repeat DWI offenders that are young and oftentimes will get one, two, or three in a 12 or 14 or 16 month period. That's of great concern, not only in terms of the swiftness in which we deal with these problems, but sets them up for these stays of adjudication, which really I don't think a lot of young people understand what they're doing when they agree to a stay in exchange for long periods of probation. Oftentimes an individual might be very much better off in terms of their future to do the 60 days or the 90 days and forget about the probation, just do the time. That may or may not be a reality, I don't know for sure, but certainly is of concern to me, and I've had an opportunity to know a number of young people, particularly when you're an employer in the construction trades where you work hard. These guys, at the end of the day, pound a few drinks, and so many employers cannot hire people because the insurance companies prohibit them from hiring them because they have a DWI on their record and the job requires driving or operating equipment. So oftentimes doors are closed. I think I have a we've all heard it. Our prisons are becoming mental health institutions. That's not what our penal system is set up for. And so those things in which we can deal with these individuals, and it's not just the latent response to the after effect, but it involves the community, involves every person sitting in the audience. Each one of us has probably been touched in some way or another by chemical dependency or addiction. Probably have a relative, might have a member of your family. You may have been touched by somebody who was a drunk driver. But it really requires all of us as members of the community to practice that early intervention and get these people help rather than waiting for something to happen. And oftentimes the penalties don't match correctly the crime. Some years ago, again, in the construction trades, there was a young man who worked on one of these subcontractor crews, a framing crew, who was one of these habitual drunk drivers. And all he ever got was a slap on the fingers over and over and over again until he finally killed somebody. Then he got 10 years in prison. And the family, you know, tried to intercede, but, you know, it's a matter of when you have these other issues, as Representative O'Neill mentioned, you can't effectively deal with them. The last thing I want to talk about is equity. We heard today in testimony that public prosecutors yield a great amount of power in terms of what they choose to prosecute, how they prosecute it, what sentences they're seeking. And it's become evident, serving on the Public Safety Committee, that, you know, a crime committed in Crookston might not get the same penalty as a crime committed in Ramsey County. and that's affecting our bed days in the prison. So I wonder, in terms of fairness, in terms of equity, whether or not there should not be some type of post-sentencing board that reviews people who are in prison and looks at what they've been prosecuted for and what their sentence is and compare that to the numbers of other people in that same system, maybe even in that same facility, who are serving a sentence for a similar crime, and how much disparity there is between the sentences. I think that's something that needs to be looked at. So youth intervention, early dealing with mental illness. We saw in the news in the last couple of weeks a family out in, not in my district, but in the Senate district, who took his whole family. It's hard for any of us to imagine that anybody that commits some of these crimes could be mentally stable or in a right state of mind. It defies all of our logical comprehension about the state of mind or condition. And obviously this individual, had risen to a great level of despair that there was no reason to face his peers or go on, and decided to end it all for not only himself but his whole family. So these are troubling, and it's not easy to deal with them, but we're spending a huge amount of resources all on the wrong end. We need to be spending more on the front end, and as I mentioned about the spreadsheet that I did, we're spending up to $100 a day per diem just on the capitalization costs of space. And we can do better in Minnesota. Thank you.
Senator Newman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, like you, I'm purely in a listening mode and learning. And to those with the various areas of expertise and to the two chairs, these would be the areas that I would request that we receive more information on as we progress with this task force. First of all, with respect to requests for more prison beds, before I would be willing to commit to spending more money on prison beds, I'd have to have a lot more information in terms of alternatives such as Appleton or maybe others that I'm not aware of. So that would be my first request. Second, I would request that we take a look at the community corrections system. To me, it's a real confusing system with the state participation and the county participation. And, should we be maybe changing that system and then look in greater detail as to utilizing it even more than what we are now? Because I think in the state of Minnesota, we have had a great deal of success with community corrections rather than prison beds. So, but again, it's such a confusing system, at least to me, that I would request more information on that with the eye towards possible reform. Third, treatment, idea of treatment keeps coming up over and over and over out of a lot of folks, be it mental health, drug, alcohol, sex, doesn't make any difference. We really do have to look at treatment for the folks who have fallen into these various categories and these various problems. Number fourth, sentencing guidelines appears to be the major driver in the need for more prison beds, and I would really like to have a much more in-depth conversation about the sentencing guidelines, the need for reform. Are there alternatives to where we could better utilize our prison system? Fifth, Senator Sharon touched on a topic involving a shift of the use of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program from the civil side into the criminal side. And I happen to agree with her a great deal. That idea, as discussed by Donovan Frank, of utilizing the civil system to keep people locked up, I don't find it troublesome. I find it scary that the government can lock people up indefinitely through a civil system. If, in fact, the folks who are locked up in that civil system are so dangerous that we cannot let them go, they should be in the prison system, not in the civil system. And I would appreciate very much if we could have a greater in-depth conversation regarding that idea as it affects our prison population. And then finally, education, training, and jobs. Senator Harrington hit the button, the head right on the nail. Education and training for folks, in my estimation, is the best criminal justice program that we could utilize. It's the best entitlement program that we could utilize. And if folks who find themselves in the criminal justice system are somehow assured of a job, and maybe it's training while they're in prison, or maybe it's training while they're in community service, I don't know. I don't have the expertise in the area, and that's why I'm asking for the information. If they have a job, I think we would really greatly reduce the number of folks that ultimately find themselves in the prison population. Thank you, Senator Letts.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair Cornish, as well. I'm really excited that we're coming together and having this discussion, and like other folks have mentioned, it's a conversation that's long overdue, and it took the possibility of coming up with $150 million for more prison beds and other options that have gotten us here. I might be the only one in the room that's actually spent time on the inside. I might be the only one in the room that's gone through treatment successfully, albeit it was several decades ago, and I'm sure that many of the systems have changed since that time. But I will say that one size doesn't fit all. And I think there was a time when we thought we could define a system, and I think the sentencing guidelines actually try to get there where we can kind of make it one size fits all. Granted, with the sentencing guidelines, there might be 40, 50, 60, 70 different blocks that we're creating that's one size fits all. But ultimately, we've designed a system that is going to cost us a lot of money over time. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to continue to spend money, or do we want to look at ways to invest money? And invest money so that we are able to keep an incarceration rate that's fairly low, is fairly important for those individuals to be removed from society and actually have a positive impact on public safety. And I actually have to agree with Ms. Moses that we need to look at some robust data. I mean, we have a really, really complicated set of numbers that we need to look at and do some cross comparisons. I shy away from just looking purely at statistics because I believe what Mark Twain said, there are lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. So I think when we look at them, we really need to look at them in the context of which we're discussing them. So I was one of the people that was really disappointed last year when we weren't able to join with Justice Reinvestment and become one of the states involved in the program. I think it's a great program that's shown great success in many states throughout the country. As mentioned, some of those states have much higher incarceration rates, but they've been able to reduce their prison populations and at the same time actually increase public safety. In states that have reduced their prison populations, they are actually decreasing the number of crimes that are actually happening. So if taking offenders and giving them the right set of skills and abilities and opportunities ultimately does three things. One, it makes public safer. Two, it reduces our incarceration costs. And three, it makes them taxpayers, which is a good thing to have happen. I think we all would rather have individuals who are contributing resources to their state versus consuming those resources. And if we do it smart, we can make that happen. So with that, I'm going to close by saying, when we consider the opportunities that are out there for possibilities of creating more prison beds, I think we should look to parts of the world that have done things differently than we have in the country of America. Several European countries do smaller prisons. They do them community-based so that individuals can remain connected to their families, which is one of the most important things that someone coming out has to deal with, is how are they able to stay connected to the families. So I would love it if we could also have Department of Corrections looked at what would it take to build, say, 10 or 20 small 50-unit community-based lockup facilities and what that might mean as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish. I'll be brief, and I think we've covered a lot today, and I think it's a great intro into the different topics related to this. I think as we talk about a prison population in Minnesota that is really, really low, and we talk about whether low-level offenders or low-level drug offenders belong in prison, you know, I think we need to also understand that it's a low-level crime until they break into your house. It's a low-level methamphetamine crime until they're supporting their habit by stealing your identity and writing thousands of dollars of checks in your name, and your credit's ruined. And they'll serve their few months in prison. And the average Minnesotan is going to take 60 days, 90 days, 120 days, heck, maybe even a few years to figure out what damage is done on their credit score and try to piece that part of their life back together. I mean, we hear a lot about victimless crimes, and I just don't believe that there is such a thing. It has an impact on society as a whole, and there's a cost to that. Someone brought up Danko orders before, and yeah, there are a lot of felons now because of violation of no contact orders. But a few times every year, we hear about, you know, she was afraid of that guy, and he kept showing up, and the cops never did anything, and now she's dead. So there's a lot of issues at play, but the idea that there are low-level crimes, or that there are lots of people in prison that don't belong there, I just flat don't agree with that assertion. Now, that being said, the best investment we can make in this state, in this area, is looking at early diversion programs and first-time offenders. The last thing we need is to take a first-time offender and put them in with a group of really experienced criminals. That's about the only way to make a bad situation worse. And so I'm a true believer in that. I'm a big believer in that. And I hope we can discuss that in future meetings.
I'll jump around here a few notes. First of all, Appleton, some of the history on that, the reason we haven't done it is the unions have a rabid fear of Appleton, and it was the public versus private. So I would like it if the commissioner, when he does that study, don't contaminate it with a public-private study we've already done. Have it be a state-owned facility or a state-rented facility, nothing to do with private. I think I'd like to see that, because the chance of ever getting it through the Senate as a private and having the governor sign it, I think, are zero. So I think we have to look at it the other way. Sentencing guidelines, I think the heat's really going to be on you. Not that you're doing anything wrong, but most of the questions are going to come to you, especially the disparity thing that I talked about just before the committee meeting. And then I would like to see a direct comparison as much as you can get it, because we probably do our grid different than some states, but I would like to see how we're sentencing people compared to other states on specific crimes, on level of drug crimes or you know, first, second, different degrees of murder and criminal sexual conduct, something like that, a direct comparison to other states with a similar, I almost called it a credit score, a criminal score, you know, what we would get in Minnesota versus other states. The county responsibilities, it's an interesting thought. Now, the county complains, in which they should, about being focused sometimes and having to bear the burden, but you're also sending us these people, county attorneys and the judges, and so I think you bear some responsibility in the whole thing, and we'll just, you know, we got to winnow out that ratio of how much you should get paid for jail space or how much is out there, how many beds are actually available to use if we wanted to, and what the rate is and how you folks negotiate it and what you're going to come up with. This whole thing is actually going to be about money just almost as much as policy, because if we do the things to fix it, we pour more money into specialty courts, give counties more money for probation, the challenge in incarceration program, the mental health beds that we want. We certainly can't send them to St. Peter. It seems like we just had another suicide there two nights ago, and two suicides and a murder in St. Peter in the last year. So, and the last thing I'll leave you with is to talk about divergence of opinions. Senator Rosen called a task force meeting, or it was actually, she was asked to by law enforcement in Martin County. And we went down there, and Josh Milo, my probation agent from our area, was there. And there was the judges, there was human services, there was counselors from the school, nurses from the school, the drug task force. There was a uniformed chief of police and two uniformed officers, county attorney, it was represented, the judge, like I said. Every aspect of health and human services, there was somebody there from the foster care program. They said that methamphetamine is coming back and it's just a rage. And one of the things they almost unanimously agreed on is don't lessen the drug crime penalties, even don't decriminalize marijuana. That was, they said marijuana is prevalent in everything across the board in the families and a gateway drug, and they said a great cause for getting into the rest of it. So that's, you know, the divergence of opinion, kind of maybe even rural metro, as there's a lot of people that don't want to decriminalize drugs at all, lower level or not, because it leads into something else. So that's the kind of political thing that we have to face when we finally come down to the votes. And I think that was about it. So looking forward to the next few meetings and getting some more data and statistics. I'm not really convinced we have a problem yet. I was a little surprised with the start of the meeting. We admitted we had this big problem. I'm not convinced of it yet, at least as far as the number. I'll have to go back and convince my constituents that we've got this huge problem with corrections when we're only, the, you know, with, we're rated like we are in the nation. And it's hard to explain all that to your constituents, everything we're talking about, so it's going to be a job. But I agree with the specialty courts, the mental health beds, and things like that, but I'm not convinced yet that we're sending too many people to prison. So, okay, that's just me.
Well, I've got just a couple of thoughts. I'd like to get more details on the DOC bonding proposal at Rush City. I'd like to learn more about the option of leasing the prison at Appleton. I think we need to explore that as something to consider. I'd like to learn more about the drug sentencing reform options. One of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission's working on this, and others have mentioned it, particularly some of the minimum sentences for drugs and for some of the other stuff that is associated with the minimum sentences throughout the statutes. Sometimes that one size fits all minimum. The reason you see a lot of departures by the judges is because they look at the case before them and they say this statute doesn't really fit this person in this crime or this situation. And if it's happening a lot, maybe it's a sign that on the ground where the individualized evaluations are going on, it just doesn't match up with the overall efforts of the legislature, and it's worth reconsidering some of those. I'd like to look at what options we have for some early other options or additional options for early release. People have gone to prison, they've spent time, they're doing well there, and maybe they don't need to spend the next 3 years there. Maybe another year is enough for them, and I don't think the legislature necessarily should make that decision. You know, as a one-size-fits-all kind of category. But I think it's worth looking at some kind of a parole panel or early release review process where we can get down below that 66%, the two-thirds minimum. Maybe we talk about a statutory change to 60% instead of 66%. And you know, Senator Sharon's bill has the parole, panel proposals. Judge Davies is in the room. He's had some proposals over the course of time dealing with parole issues as well. So those are the kind of things I'd like to look at. I love hearing all these different ideas that have come from the task force members as well. I think it's going to be some very productive and helpful information and discussions that we're going to have. All worth getting into and seeing if we can find some direction to go together. And I'm with Representative Cornish. You know, I've seen my own personal experience in terms of where I think people go to prison that shouldn't go to prison, and I've seen people go to prison that definitely needed to go to prison. I think maybe it's worth intellectually going through the evaluation. Are we imprisoning the right people? Do all of them need to be imprisoned, and are there some ways that we can avoid some of those costs and improve public safety at the same time? Some of them, they learn more being in prison than they would learn on the street in terms of how to be effective criminals. We don't want that either. So the next meeting is going to be October 21st. Thank you, whoever pointed out that the 18th is a Sunday. It'll be the 21st, and the meeting after that will be November 18th. I would anticipate for the next meeting we will certainly hear about the Rush City bonding request and about more detail on the options of leasing the Appleton private facility. Beyond that, I know that Representative Cornish has some specific ideas, and there are others that have raised ideas here today. We will flesh out the agenda before then and let you all know, so we can have another invigorating meeting. Thank you all for your participation and the work that's ahead of us, and we are now adjourned.